No, we don't need it for them.
Oh, okay.
Close enough. We're declaring one.
That's right. The important people are here.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to order with however many of us are going to be here. We hear Representative Kenner is excused today, and we hear Representative Hoyle is running a bit late. She'll be joining us soon. Others are obviously running a bit late as well. We're going to open an informational meeting and start off with hearing what's going on in the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. You know, welcome Mr. King back to the building. He's been trying to hide from us for the last few weeks. But glad you're back, Rocky.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the executive director for the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange. Amy?
And my name is Amy Favre. I'm the deputy director for the Health Insurance Exchange. Good morning.
We have provided you, I know we only have a short 10 minutes or so, but we have provided you with what we call
the 20 minutes, Rocky.
Pardon?
You have 20 minutes.
Oh, great.
20 minutes, great. We have provided you with a 30,000-foot view of kind of our timeline that we are kind of appearing to, and it's broken into five categories, and we'll talk about those in a second, because they primarily, the ones that touch our customers, are really the public. We didn't go into a lot of the technical pieces that really the public doesn't see, and I think it's important to note that we have a whole project management structure behind this, you know, with 11 project teams and a lot more documents, but when we provide and hand out 18 pages of a project plan, people have no idea where you are or what you're doing. So we've really tried to distill this into one page, and that's difficult to do. The second thing is, this is a public document that's on our webpage, so people can see in terms of the major milestones in all these different areas, the different stakeholders and other state agencies and legislators that want to see where we are and where we should be working. This pretty well lays out kind of where we are. I should tell you that what's here today will not be here tomorrow. This is in sandstone. It's a fluid document. We react to new federal regulations. We react to bumps in the road. We react to smooth roads, so that time frames often shift back and forth. And we update this on a daily or at least a weekly basis to reflect where we are in terms of the projects that we're working on. I'm going to just talk briefly about the major milestones, and I'm going to turn it over to Amy. As most of you know, I've been gone for the last couple months, and so I'm back, but she has, I think, a much better grasp of kind of where we are. I kind of know where we were going to be, but she knows kind of where we are, so it's kind of good to do that. But the major milestones really speak to the two federal reviews that we've had. One passed last November, 2011, and one that was just completed on May 7th. And that's where the federal government comes out and they look at really where you are, not just from an IT perspective, but from a policy perspective and a program perspective. There's kind of good news, bad news that comes out of that review from my perspective. The good news is they tell you that, or told Oregon, that we're really a lot farther along since November than they ever thought. The good news was that we are probably farther along than most states, if not all the states, not just from an IT piece, because we were an early innovator, but also on the program and policy structure basis, that we've really progressed quite well. The bad news is that scares me, because I see what lies ahead, and if we're ahead, I get very concerned about where the federal government is or other states at this time. But it was really good news at this last federal review, and Oregon Health Authority can, and the exchange, who work collaboratively together on trying to get this project going, I think can at least take about 5 seconds to breathe and smile, and then put the frown back on and get back to work. We have in in August of this year, we'll be developing a grant that will take us through 2014. Really, it's to cover the last of the build and the first year of operation. We have some time, we're hoping, after August, because it's still pretty early for us to know what many of the pieces are going to look like. But we'll at least start framing that and getting that back to the federal government for them to start looking at what some of our planning is from a financial basis. And in November is due what we call our federal readiness report, where we actually make application to the federal government and say, look, for the last year, here are 6 months, here's what we've been doing. And we think that you ought to give us the stamp to move forward. You don't have to be ready January 1 or November, but what you've got to do is demonstrate what you've accomplished in the last 6-7 months and meet certain technical requirements and have the plan in place to make sure that October of 2013 you're able to press the button and start. So that's kind of the 30,000 foot level, and I'll turn it over to Amy, who can look at qualified health plans, some of the customer service, web portal, and outreach and marketing. Amy?
Okay. The next category we have on the roadmap is the qualified health plans, and this timeline lays out the process that we're following for selecting qualified health plans that will be sold through the exchange. There are, starting last week, we've had two different stakeholder work groups focusing on this. One contains representatives from consumer advocacy organizations as well as business associations from the state, and then another that's unique to carriers to try and get input before we actually come up with a proposal of what are the things. You know, there are certain criteria for qualified health plans that are laid out in the Affordable Care Act. Those are federal requirements. But then we also, as a state, have the option of creating additional requirements. Senate Bill 99 allowed us to do that, and the feds allow us to do that. So what should those be? What should those look like? We want to have the criteria for qualified health plans meet both the needs of the consumers who are coming to the exchange expecting a product that has a lot of value for their premium dollar, but also, you know, are not such an onerous burden for the carriers that they don't want to participate in the exchange. So it's finding that line. So we have two work groups currently focused on that. At the end of June, we will develop a proposal for our board to consider. We will also go to our Consumer Advisory Committee, and then, of course, out to the public for general vetting. Our current timeline is that we plan to release a request for applications in September of this year. That would be for the carriers who would like to participate in the exchange to send us their proposals for qualified health plans. Those proposals would be due at the end of the year in December, and we expect that in the March-April of 2013 timeframe, we would notify carriers of the successful plans. At the same time, Oregon Health Authority and the Insurance Division have convened a work group around the essential health benefits. That's the benchmark plan that will be sent by the governor eventually to the Department of Health and Human Services. As a reminder, the essential benefits are the benefit package that will be required of all plans sold in the state, not just those sold through the exchange. So the exchange is participating in that process, but it's a broader process than just us. So both the health authority and the insurance division are staffing that. In August, there will be a joint board meeting of our board, the Health Insurance Exchange Board, and the Oregon Health Policy Board, to hear the recommendations of this work group and then to forward their joint recommendation onto the governor. In the next line in your roadmap is the customer service and community partners. This area of our work is big. It really contains three parts. It's the what are we doing around agents, what are we doing around navigators, and what are we doing around a customer service or call center. For the agents piece, we have the board heard our staff proposal for an agent management plan. That proposal is on our website. It's gotten wide vetting around the state. We've traveled around the state meeting with agents and other folks. We're currently going through a similar process for our Navigator program. We haven't yet gone public with a proposal. It's going to be presented, a very draft proposal will probably be presented to our board next month in June. And then after that, we will shop that around get feedback, get input, and then probably finalize that a little bit later in the summer. Just as a reminder, the Navigator program is going to be dependent on our ability to fundraise for that program because we are not allowed to use our federal grant dollars for the Navigator grants. The customer service center, our call center, that piece is still very much under development. We're currently doing a cost-benefit analysis to determine, you know, several things. One, is our call center one that we want to have be staffed internally? We want to have that staffed with Exchange staff, or do we want to contract it out? That's one question we're pondering. Another is, how do we work with OHA, since our vision for our customer service center is one place where any Oregonian can get assistance with our with the Exchange products, whether they ultimately are eligible for Medicaid or for a tax credit or for no subsidy. And so we want to be able to come to one place and get the assistance they need rather than giving them a phone number to go call somewhere else. So we're working with OHA on figuring out how to do that most seamlessly. For our outreach and marketing, we have, and we reported to you in February on this as well, been around the state doing an extensive outreach and market outreach effort, working with stakeholders on a variety of the different policy issues that we're developing right now. We generally have been having policy-specific work groups around a certain area where we bring folks together for a finite period of time to get that input. We also, though, have a standing committee, the Consumer Advisory Committee, which is a standing committee of our board. We've also developed a tribal technical work group to help us work through some of the very specific requirements that are in the Affordable Care Act in relation to the benefits that tribal members can receive. And then, of course, our advisory work groups for our project teams. We've also been recently, and it will become more common, starting to post general questions to the public on our website, and then we send out a blast to our listserv. Sort of in the preliminary stages of developing certain policies, there's questions that we'd just like to get general feedback on. We posted a question about a month ago on, you know, what are the top three things that are most important to you in a health plan? What are you basically, we're trying to get at, what are the search criteria that you're going to care most about when we have our plans online? And we got over 400 responses from our blast saying, this question's out there, please send us your thoughts. So we're going to continue doing that since it's been a successful way to get more voices involved. We've also been working on a comprehensive communications and marketing plan. So this is really targeted at what do we want our broad outreach and educational effort to look like come 2013, once we're getting ready for launch of the Exchange. And this plan will take us through the initial open enrollment. We've been working with a communications consultant on that. We expect we'll finalize that in the next month or so. And as I think we've reported before, we're likely to call ourselves something other than the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange Corporation as we begin our broader outreach efforts, because that's not meaningful to most people. And so probably when we're here in September, we'll be able to tell you what our thoughts are on the new name, or at least the doing business as name. For our web portal, Ruck, is there anything you want to add? So I've just been trudging through.
Nope.
Okay.
Great.
For our Exchange web portal, the IT work that Rocky touched on earlier, this timeline mostly focuses on the work underway so far, both to develop the IT system and also the user experience. We're working very collaboratively with the Oregon Health Authority and their IT shop on this project. As you may recall, the Early Innovator Grant, which funds specifically the IT work, is housed at the Oregon Health Authority, and they hold the contract with Oracle, and we're working very closely with them. They have the dollars to do the development, but we on the corporate side have to tell them what we want it to look like. You know, what do we want it to do? What's the functionality that the website needs in order to meet our policy goals and our mission? Since and beginning of this year, end of January, early February, we have been undertaking an intensive business requirements gathering process where we have 12 teams working concurrently with, so there's staff from the Exchange, staff from the Health Authority, IT department, to define for every line of business what it is that we want this website to do. In highly technical terms that the developers can then take and code based on. So we're currently in the process. We've made the most progress so far on the shop and the pre-screening functionality for that system, and the rest of those requirements will be wrapping up in the next, probably about the next 45 days or so.
That is, Mr. Chair, kind of a quick overview. I want you to know, we want to be straight with you. There are a lot of risks. This is a major project, not only from an IT perspective, but from a policy perspective, and one that has a lot of unknowns, given the Supreme Court, given the elections, given just the rules and regulations that are coming out. We've brought the corporation up rather quickly. We've pulled together. We're working closely with OHA, LFO, other state agencies, our stakeholders. I mean, we've got like 8 or 9 different consumer, business, and technical work groups that are working with staff and trying to pull this together. But we may sometimes appear to be smiling, but inside we are scared to death. This is a major challenge for us. So we're here to answer any questions that you may have.
Representative Thompson.
Okay. I noticed that we have 2 co-ops in Oregon that have been funded at $115 million. It's not a lot of money in healthcare, but it's not chump change. Can you talk a little bit about the role of these co-ops, how they fit into the whole picture of things, and
sure, Mr.
why
Chair,
we've got so much federal money going into them?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I'm going to ask Amy to do that, and partly because they actually presented at the last board meeting and gave some of their thoughts. And Amy, I think you were there, and if you don't feel comfortable, I'll go ahead.
No, but that's fine.
That might be more up to date, I think.
Representative Thompson, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the co-ops were, a piece of the Affordable Care Act. So I really can't speak to why the funding is there, but it's there. And 2 co-ops were awarded initial startup funding in Oregon. Those co-ops will have the opportunity to apply to have qualified health plans through the exchange, just like any commercial carrier in the state. They will be required to meet the same requirements, both with the insurance division and our criteria for qualified health plans. So they will provide another option for consumers. And when they came and spoke, both of the co-ops came and presented to our board at their May meeting. And I think they're both looking at filling sort of different niche roles in the market than the commercial market currently fits. I think one of them is interested in playing a significant role with the Medicaid churn population, so the population that, you know, either is close to the income limit for Medicaid or maybe currently on Medicaid, but, you know, if their wages increase, then they would fall off of Medicaid, and they may go back and forth. And so they're looking at, can they play a role in strengthening continuity of care for that particular population? But from our perspective at the exchange, it's another plan offering, and be welcome to be offered in the exchange if they meet the criteria for qualified health plans.
I don't understand what's the point, though, of federal funding to set up these co-ops. Private insurance companies aren't getting that kind of funding to set up their programs. What are we trying to accomplish? I realize you didn't do it.
You're asking the road first.
What are the feds trying to accomplish by doing this, and what does it do to the competitive platform among the players?
Rep. Thompson, Chair Conley,
go ahead.
Members of the committee. I cannot answer that question. That was part of the negotiations for the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
And I'm
right for this one, yeah. As I can, but I gotta go back.
Representative Conger?
I apologize if you addressed this before I got here. I apologize to my colleagues for being late. So if you did address it, don't bother repeating yourself. We'll just take it offline. I can reach out in the hall and ask the question again. But in terms of risk to coming live on time, one of the things that I perceive as a significant issue is the integration between actually operating and the development of the IT backbone. So they're not different issues in the sense that they're obviously related, but from a management perspective, you're talking about, I think you said 9 work groups or 12 work groups within the corporation, and integrating the work that all of those groups are doing seems like a challenge. Have you hired people who have done very large IT projects? I mean, do you have the expertise inside the corporation to accomplish that?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, this is really complicated. We could spend, I think, just the next half hour talking about the IT portion. We have a firm that we've hired internally to the corporation that is helping really the project on the project management piece of this that has extensive experience. Point B, they have four people that they've put on site really helping us through the business requirement process, the project management process, the planning through the whole piece of that, working with all 12 project management teams, as well as helping us really look at how to build up the corporate structure to support the IT. It's not just, you know, it's both ways on that. We also have hired Maximus as a quality assurance contractor, and that's looking at not just the IT, but the corporate piece and how they blend and how they come together, not only within the corporation, but with the IT and OHA and their contractors. We also will be going out on the IT basis for a third contract with the user interface. You know, we've used IDO initially, but they didn't go quite far enough in some of the Oregon-specific research and the shop exchange that we needed. So we're bringing someone in and then really staffing through our consultants an integrator under all those different processes. So the risks, 99. I mean, it's up there. This is probably one of the most largest and complex projects that the state and a public corporation have ever taken on. But we feel very strongly that we've put the pieces in place, and, you know, to some degree, you're rolling dice. I'm just going to be frank. This is really tough. There's a lot of hours being put in to try to get this. A good partnership with LFO, OHA, and the corporation.
Wait, just one quick follow-up, and this isn't really a fair question, but I'm curious. What would you rate the risk, setting aside the regulatory and legal issues that you've already mentioned, but just setting that aside, if everything there went according to plan, what would you rate the risk that you will not meet your deadline to go live?
Mr. Chair, Representative Conger, I don't know if I have a percentage of that. I can tell you that when I took this job, Patrick Holland, the CFO of Massachusetts, who brought up an exchange, said, no matter what, you will not sleep for 2 years, and I haven't.
But where are you on the two-year timeline of no sleep? Yeah, that's the question.
Rep. Conger, Chair Green.
Somebody says, I sleep like a baby. I wake up every 2 hours crying.
Yeah.
We are, you know, as we complete our requirements process, we'll have a clear sense within the next 60 days of the full scope of this project. And at that point, we'll be doing an assessment with the health authority to determine, you know, sort of in absence of unknown, you know, delays in federal regulations, can we do this job as currently scoped out in the time we have with the resources we have? And if the answer to any of those parts is no, then we will either pursue additional resources with the federal government or limit the scope so that we, you know, we may have to have that conversation of what's the absolute necessity, you know, what pieces of this absolutely have to get completed in order for open enrollment to happen successfully on October 1st of 2013. And it may be that some other things that we would like to do will have to come in phase two. But we'll be looking at that scope to ensure that we can meet that critical deadline. It may not be the full enchilada, you know, at that point, but we'll be doing that evaluation this summer once we know sort of the full extent of our business requirements.
I would add, in 30 days, we have a risk assessment that's due from our quality assurance vendor. That's our first corporate risk assessment. OHA has had that risk assessment done on an IT basis, an ongoing process since we started this project. I quote Bob Cummings, if we aren't read in everything, then the quality assurance folks aren't doing their job. They really, you know, we're looking forward to that because it's not going to be something we smile about, but it's something we need because it's going to show all the areas that we really need to pay attention to. So that first one's due in 30 days for us from a corporate basis.
Guys, thank you very much.
Can I ask?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
The Navigator, you mentioned not being able to use the federal funds for the Navigator program. Where are you thinking of trying to seek those funds?
Representative Kenny Geyer, Chair Greenlick. We are currently looking at a variety of options, including going after some grant dollars from private foundations, working with the health authority, since some of the population that program would serve are Medicaid eligible, as well as you know, some more creative ideas that we haven't vetted with anybody yet, but probably foundation grant funding is the most likely, and our success in that will determine. We've started laying out what our ideal program would look like to reach statewide and really be effective. We may have to scale that back initially. But after our funding is our own, self-sustaining funding based on the administrative fee as allowed in Senate Bill 99, then we can use our funding for Navigator. So we're really looking at the first 18 months.
Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much. Can we have the scoop, please? This is the only committee that has coffee over here, if any of you would like some. You guys look familiar.
That's good.
Silent. Good, good.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, Director of the Oregon Health Authority. We're here to give you an update as to where we are in bringing the coordinated care organizations up and online and our work in healthcare transformation at the statewide level. It's hard to believe that it's only been about 10 weeks since the February session was over, and a lot has taken place in terms of our ability to take what was Senate Bill 1580 and now implement it. So we're here today to let you know about all the work that's gone on both within the state as well as an incredible amount of work that's gone on in just about every community in Oregon across the healthcare system. So let me turn it over to Mike, who's going to give a quick update as to where we are on some of the issues with getting the CCOs up and going, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about where we are in our process with the federal government and some of the issues around the federal funding that you may have heard about.
Chair Greenlick, committee members, for the record, Mike Bonetto in the governor's office. You have a packet in front of you. I'm just going to go through some high points, and as Bruce mentioned, he's going to kind of walk through some of a waiver update and the federal funding piece. As you know, we submitted early March our waiver to CMS along with the funding request that we were fortunate enough to receive a bit ago. Early March, we had requests for applications were posted for public comment and then also finalized, and we've been moving through the rules process. And we just completed our permanent rules advisory committee, just had their final meeting on Friday. So those rules will get filed mid-June, and then with an August 1 effective date as we go live with our CCOs. The one thing that I did want to highlight as we get into some discussion just on the CCO process, evaluation, and certification is that we are right now really in the middle of all of that, looking at making those final decisions by early next week. So with that caveat, Bruce and I are up here. We can certainly answer some questions in what detail, somewhat limited, so we may take the fifth on some just in terms of just how much information we can actually disclose at this time. As some of you know, we had a large response of letters of intent. Over 50 letters of intent were received. And as we have talked to you in the past, we have broken this down into four waves of application. So our first going live August 1, and then September, October, and November. And I think that really has benefited a number of folks around the state just with their differing levels of readiness and how stakeholders have come together. I think the good news is that we looked at this, we had 14 applicants in the first wave. And as we look at that in terms of just how that could potentially cover the Oregon Health Plan population, that covers over 90% at this point in time. Granted, not all 14 have been certified. We're still going through that. But I think that certainly is a good sign for us. You have another document that says CCO applicant public presentations. And this one just gives you a breakdown that of all the public meetings that are going to be happening or have happened around the state. And this is, you know, something for every CCO that has to have a public meeting for their application process. So you have a lot of meetings, I think, within your districts, within your areas. So if you have any interest, you can certainly attend. And this has really kind of been a great opportunity for the public to get exposed to what has happened kind of at the local level. There's another document there that really shows out of those 14 who have submitted applications, the applicant name, and then really that proposed service area. So it really gives you an idea of just the geography that's being covered right now. And I think, you know, as you can tell, we really have a large part of the state that is being covered. In terms of timeline, just high-level overview, we had the technical portion of the application that was due at the end of April. The financial component of that was due last week, with our work being done right now with the hope of getting those CCOs certified by early next week. Then we all have some tight time frames to get contracts signed and turned around to CMS by the middle of June, with the goal of having new enrollees to those CCOs August 1. My final comments would just be, you know, we've been traveling the state for, I think, some time now, Bruce, myself, Sean Colmer, and I think it really has been quite amazing to see the level of partnership and collaboration with, you know, stakeholders who have never really talked to each other before. So I think we have really made some great headway in a short amount of time, and you know, we're looking forward to getting this stuff launched August 1. So with that, I'll turn it over to Bruce, who'll give you an update on the waiver and the federal funding.
Thanks, Mike. As Mike mentioned, and I think as you know, we submitted our waiver to the federal government on March 1st. The waiver really does two things. It allows us to provide Medicaid services through these new coordinated care organizations. And probably the biggest issue and most substantive issue around that waiver request is the ability to allow these new coordinated care organizations to use Medicaid funding in a flexible way, to be able to look at new and innovative ways to use the Medicaid dollars in the provision of health care. As you know, the federal government is the majority partner in our Medicaid program. They pay approximately 63% of the expenses, the state about 37%. And as a result, they clearly have a major hand in how the program is run. And hence, there is this waiver process whereby we ask for a variety of flexibilities. And the discussion with CMS is really around what are the things that we need their approval to do and what are the things that we can do without that under our current waiver authority. We've been working with CMS on this idea for over a year now. We had been meeting with them what was monthly over the fall. They became weekly meetings over the winter. So when the waiver request came in to CMS, this wasn't as if this was news to them. We've been working through a lot of this. We had a number of work groups. So we're fairly confident based on all the work that's been done and some assurances from Secretary Sebelius that we'll get approval of that waiver request by July 1. Along with the waiver request was a funding request that went in that I believe many of you have heard about. And let me just spend a moment or two going through that. The funding request was through a program called the Designated State Health Programs. It referred to as DSHP, D-S-H-P. And this is a federal program whereby the feds match currently unmatched state funding for health programs that support low-income individuals. So as an example, we currently as a state provide a fair amount of funding to local counties and communities for indigent mental health care. It's pure state general fund. And we know that there are many of the individuals served by those programs who one day are uninsured and the next day they're often on the Medicaid program. There's a clear nexus between that funding and what we're doing in the health plan. And as a result, looking at the programs like that, the feds will provide federal match for that program. What that does is then, rather than a program fully general fund funded, it now becomes partially general fund and partially federal fund. It frees up some of those general funds that were used in that program. The program can continue to operate fully funded, but now it frees up some general funds. Those general funds can be used in the health plan, as any general fund would be, and then those general funds can receive the same match that we do in our Medicaid program. We have an agreement with the feds to match sufficient programs to free up what are $230 million in state funds in year one, $230 million of state funds in year two, $108 million in year three, $68 million in year four, and $68 million in year five. Year one starting July 1, 2012, this coming July. So that's the federal agreement. On the state side, what we've agreed to do are really three things. We've agreed to organize and deliver care within the coordinated care organizations. And indeed, the federal funding can only go into the coordinated care organizations. We've agreed to lower the trend in per capita Medicaid costs by 2 percentage points. That's not lowering the budget by 2 percentage points. It's saying if the trend on an individual were about 6%, we would now lower the growth from what would be 6% down to 4%. In essence, trying to bring the growth in healthcare spending down to what is more commensurate with state general fund growth, CPI, wages, et cetera. And likewise, we've agreed to improve the health of Medicaid recipients along with that, because one of the easiest ways to lower costs is simply to not provide care. And the goal here is to provide care in different ways so that we can lower costs and improve health care. By doing that, through this waiver, the federal investment would be returned within 5 years. By somewhere in the middle of the fourth year, the federal investment is returned. And then over the next 5 years, there's about a $9 billion net of that initial $1.95 billion investment in that comes back in state and federal funding. So over the second 5 years, in essence, there's about a $6 billion savings to the federal government and approximately a $3 billion savings to state general fund. And by doing this, the Medicaid program becomes more financially sustainable as costs are brought in line with state revenue growth, and the health of the Medicaid program, the health of Medicaid recipients improve. We've got some timelines that we're working through with the feds right now. We're in some final negotiations on the terms and conditions of our waiver. And indeed, when that's completed and we've got an agreement to complete that by July 1, there'll be this agreement will be fully codified, and we'll be able to move forward as a state. So let me stop there and see what questions you might have.
President Conger?
I just was struggling with the math. If we're lowering the cost by 2%, by the way, I would love it if you could go through those numbers again, because I didn't see them in what we're getting from the federal government. The part that I was struggling with is how do we save all those billions of dollars if we're only reducing the increase in healthcare costs by 2%, and it's only Medicaid that's in it, and right now it's about $3 billion total. 2% of $3 billion is a number that still has a lot of zeros, but it's a long way from the savings that I think you've said over many years.
So how do we get there?
Chair Greenick, Representative Conger, I, I, I will show you the numbers year by year, but indeed the 2% off of what would be a continued 2% increase every year compounded, it's 2% off of what, rather than a 6% growth, it would be a 4%
Is the average you're expecting 6% over time?
Right. That's about what it's been. But it doesn't matter where you start, it's a 2% decrease. And one of the issues is that the enrollment continues to increase. So part of the savings that one gets is, again, we're seeing not only a growth in the per capita cost, but there's also a growth in the population. And quite honestly, where there's a huge return in investment to the feds, not as much to the state, is that in year 2014, through the Affordable Care Act, there are approximately 200,000 additional people that come onto the Medicaid program. For the first 2 years of that, that's 100% federally funded. So now, if you look at the math, you're looking at what's right now, that's a 30% increase in our current Medicaid program that is fully federally funded. So the dollars do indeed work out that the feds get their money back, and we can show you that in a year-by-year analysis. It is mind-boggling, but we can show the dollars by which that happens, and that's been one of the key things that I think led to the federal approval of this, is their understanding that without states like ours taking efforts to reduce and flatten the cost curve, that the Medicaid program nationally becomes unsustainable. This isn't just a state issue, it's a federal issue.
Representative Conger, I think that when we were having these discussions with the feds, I think, you know, one of their main concerns was having other states wanting to jump on this. And I think, you know, we made it clear this would be fantastic. And I think we did some initial calculations to say if every state in the nation really held their trend line down 2 percentage points, that's $1.5 trillion. So, again, when you start to compound it like that, it really does add up into real dollars. But I think, you know, what we're looking at is getting the flexibility so we can manage that 2% differently.
Just to clarify, it's not 2% then growth in budget, it's 2% growth in per participant cost.
2 percentage points is correct.
Bruce, you've got 14 applications. My assumption always has been you won't have 14 perfect applications. There'll be some number, I've assumed some rather large proportion of that won't be ready to go under your application. To what extent is there a budget hazard in the next year based on the inability to certify most or all of those applications? How much does the federal return depend upon having certified CCOs operational in the next fiscal year?
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, the federal, it's one of the issues that we're working on with the feds right now, is where and how all that funding gets used. I think that we certainly need to see what I would say is a majority of the Medicaid program into CCOs by the beginning of the year, in order to make this a viable option.
Beginning of the fiscal year.
Beginning of the calendar year, January 1.
I'm worried that you're going to certify CCOs that aren't really ready to be certified simply because there's a fiscal pressure, and I hope you.
I think I can assure you that this is a large procurement. And we have clear criteria. And we have applicants that have been working on meeting those criteria. And the decisions are going to be made on the ability to meet the criteria. It's not going to be made around budget issues, political issues, the names of organizations, or anything extraneous other than what clearly are the ability to demonstrate that organizations can meet those criteria. This is a very serious procurement. It's one in which organizations have worked hard on, and it's one in which we take very, very seriously. And like any public procurement, it will, I believe, stand up to the scrutiny that is going to be necessary to assure the integrity of the process and the fact that the decisions are being made for the right reasons.
Comment on that? Mike, you want to comment on that?
Well, I just have a comment on the budget. You brought up your point in front of the budget pressure, and I think this is the one thing that we're really trying to emphasize, that, you know, this $1.9 billion that we now have is, we're considering kind of upfront federal investment. I think we don't want people to think that we now have solved the budget crisis and, you know, everything is perfect. I think we've given ourselves some breathing room, and now we have an opportunity to actually achieve those cost savings that can then be reinvested within our local communities. I think as we looked at the budget, you know, when Bruce and I were developing that budget of $239 million in terms of cost savings, we had, you know, financial analysts and actuaries look at what was potentially achievable. And now we've been able to fill that and give that really back to local communities to figure out how they can do this within the next, you know, 12 to 18 months.
Thank you. Representative Kitty Guy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The $1.9 billion is contingent on the savings of 2% in growth per year. Have they given you all 5 years because you're going to be getting declining amounts, or do they? Is there a chance at year two or three they say, hey, you're not making progress enough? What is our risk there?
Chair Greenlake, Representative Kenny Geyer, members of the committee, that's what we're working out in the terms and conditions of the waiver, where we believe this.
Well, okay.
We may need more dollars for the light on.
Shut them back off. That was good.
Yeah, that was kind of nice.
Were you looking for wood lighting?
Hopefully that's not any symbolism.
No.
Federal dollars.
the way that we anticipate this agreement will get worked out is as follows. One is that we'll have a number of milestones to meet along the way. The feds understand that we're not going to achieve the 2% reduction next month.
Right.
That we hope to achieve what is a 1% reduction in year two, and by the end of year two, a 2% reduction. We will need to meet milestones, and if we don't meet milestones, we won't get any additional dollars. The question has come up on the flip side of that, would we owe back what we've been given, and the answer to that is no. But this is, in essence, a performance-based agreement. As we perform, those dollars will come forth. And what we're working on now are what those checkpoints and milestones are to be in the terms and conditions of the waiver.
Senator Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you indulging me.
Happy to have you with us.
Thank you.
Always good to have the Ways and Means contact here with us.
Well, I'm splitting myself between two committees at the same time this morning, so I apologize if I come and go. But and obviously, from the Ways and Means perspective, the budget numbers are very important to me. But I'd like to go back a little bit to the contract negotiations and the procurement process, and I'm going to throw my question out now because I'm really looking forward to hearing some of the presentations from the CCOs. But from your perspective, I'm worried about the ultimate implementation, and I know that there's unprecedented community conversation going on with a variety of providers in our communities that are forming these CCOs. But ultimately, the results in improved health care are going to be completely dependent on whether or not the CCO organization can count on all of the additional contractual agreements that they're going to have throughout the spectrum of the service delivery. to have all of the components in place, the negotiators, the follow or the navigators and the follow-up personnel and all of those things that we envision in helping a person's health improve. Where are the checks and balances from your end of it to make sure that all of those things can actually come from the literal providers at the, if you will, street level in the community?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cowan, great question. And part of what we're looking at is a process that is indeed going to unfold over the next year or two. We're talking about, and I think what you're getting at is the ability of organizations to begin to change how care is delivered in their communities. And we've got, I believe, two ways to do that. One is in the application process. Certainly what organizations have done is outlined a plan for how they're going to implement this at the ground level. We're going to look at that plan. That's going to be evaluated for its ability to be successful, much as any application would review that. Secondly, these applicants are going to have a readiness review, that before a contract's executed, there's a review of readiness to do that. And then in contracts, there'll be a number of likewise milestones that organizations need to meet in terms of their ability to deliver on what is the promise. So I think that built in to the process are a number of checks and balances. This is a public process. It's a public procurement. There's, as I indicated to Representative Greenlick, that applicants are going to need to produce plans that are realistic and achievable and demonstrate that they can do that. And we will continue to provide the appropriate oversight. The notion behind these coordinated care organizations has been, from the outset, for business to be done differently in communities, to promote innovation, to look at and give communities the tools to do things differently. And I believe that's going to be a process that we've got to allow to happen in order to not just keep doing business as we have.
Follow up?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question on the other side of this whole scheme, from your perspective, and hopefully we'll hear it from the CCOs as well. We've had a lot of discussion in community meetings and in various places that part of getting healthier requires patient responsibility to accomplish those goals. And the one question that I have yet to hear whether or not we're addressing in the setup process is while we are all concerned about patients' ability to choose, clients' ability to choose their providers, is there also any sort of a commitment built into the overall structure that says those individuals need to stick with a provider for a while and, if you will, avoid the doctor shopping that's fairly common out there, to put it real plainly?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Cowan, two issues there. I mean, one issue I think that you addressed at the end was one of patient choice in doctor shopping and issues of that. And we certainly have some rules in place within the Medicaid program that do minimize that to some degree. I think the bigger issue that you raised is one that's come up very frequently during the discussions about transformation, which was the larger issue of patient responsibility. In fact, Representative Conger raised it several months ago as a key issue, and We agree that certainly an issue not just unique to Medicaid, but I think to all of us and all of our health is the degree to which we take personal responsibility for our health, what we eat, what we drink, how much we exercise, what we smoke, what we shouldn't smoke, etc. And it's a very, very difficult question that I think we're grappling with, not just in the Medicaid program, but in all of healthcare. And we've made a commitment to, as we get through this first phase of getting these CCOs up and going, that the next piece that we need to work on is a conversation at a statewide level of how we can look at some of those issues of personal responsibility. I think that they're very important, but I don't know that anyone has totally answered those yet. And we have to have an open and honest discussion and plan for that.
You got to stop those skiers, you know. Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To drill down on what Representative Cowan, I think, is asking a little further, one of my big concerns as we move forward, and we've had this discussion before, is involvement of practitioners in the planning process. I have a letter from the ONA to the Tri-County Collaborative asking to be included, includes the OMA. I'm hearing from the Association of Pediatric Physicians that they're not included. I'm hearing from a bevy of pharmacists, they're not included. The only ones I'm hearing from that seem very comfortable right now are the dentists. And at some point, this is going to become critical. So the last focus group I had in my district with a dozen doctors, they told me to the person they have no intention of accepting any additional Medicaid patients, and they very well may reduce the number. We don't have enough veterinarians to fill the gap in the rural area. So we've got an on-the-ground problem. I'm attending a lot of CCO meetings, and I'm hearing a lot of discussion about moving money around and these sorts of things. I'm not hearing anything about what we're going to do in the practice of medicine to reduce the cost and increase the quality. In fact, at the ground level, there's a whole lot of skepticism about that. So I think we still have a disconnect that we'd better be addressing very soon, or we're going to have just a really great insurance coverage program, but no service available to the patients.
Is there a question you want to answer, or you just want to?
Yeah, it's how does this all fit together, and when do we get to the discussion of what's expected of providers and how they're going to participate in this process? And I don't see it. I talk to doctors who have good ideas of how they might be able to change the dynamic, but they're not being listened to. Their point of view, they're not being listened to.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thompson, I certainly understand the frustration. I think, you know, our point at this time would be, you know, we're in the middle of, you know, evaluating kind of these CCO applications. If you recall, you know, back in House Bill 3650 and Senate Bill 1580 and in the CCO implementation proposal, I mean, we had a lot of discussion and input. I mean, certainly you guys, you know, really approved what that criteria was to be about. And I think that's really what we're really holding out there right now, saying, can you show us a new care model? Can you show us your integration between mental health, behavioral health? Can you show us how you're going to be able to build out a medical home? I mean, so those are all the things that we're actually, you know, looking at now in terms of, you know, on an applicant by applicant basis and making that determination. And, you know, we'll let you know kind of next week and kind of where we landed.
Next week. I'll give you a call.
Absolutely.
Next week is fine.
Yeah. Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me another chance to ask questions. This is related to some of the things that we've been talking about, the idea of innovation. I mean, I think that, you know, that's a critical component of the success here is that, and from my perspective, I felt like when we passed transformation, the idea was to push that innovation and the incentives to innovate down to a level where people who are involved directly in patient care would have both an investment and some risk, I guess, shared risk, and some reasons to accomplish those things. And this relates to the comments by Representative Thompson in that sense. There's also this governance issue where we're trying to make sure that governance is connected to communities. And I think we really struggled with that. We processed that very carefully and tried to be very thoughtful about setting up that governance structure. And it turns out it got very complicated, but I think on balance, we probably did the best that we could. And then in addition to that, we had, I think several members had raised the risk of what happens if a CCO fails, and the idea of reserves and all of that was talked about. Those three concepts, governance with a connection to the community, the provider community, but the patient community, the innovation, sort of having enough CCOs with those connections out there to sponsor that innovation and then share it, and this concept of risk, all relate to my question, which is this. I only see 14 applicants here. There isn't a lot of overlap. In fact, I'm not sure there's really any except in the Tri-County area. My question is, are you looking at this as this is just the first wave and there, you know, this is going to double and you're going to reassign, or are you going to encourage competition? Competition is not the right word, but let me step back a second. I'm not being fully articulate. What I'm getting at is, and let's take the Tri-County because I think that is the overlap here, as an example. If that all goes into one CCO, the connection to the community might be a little less in each individual community, or the governance structure might become so burdensome. There's also maybe a little less accountability. If there was one big statewide CCO, for example, there would be no accountability, and an enormous amount of risk would translate onto the state.
We're running into time issues. Could you be very helpful? If you've got to a question, you can answer quickly. Because we're now over time. You're close.
So the question is, what is your view about the limited number and the need to assign tighter regions, I guess, to have more CCOs rather than less, to encourage that accountability and reduce risk by having maybe a little bit smaller footprint than one big? And again, I am talking about the Tri-County region because it's so significant to our success.
Take a first cut, Mr. Chair, Representative Conger. I mean, I think the intent all along, and we've certainly had a lot of discussion with legislature, was to build upon the infrastructure that we have today with managed care. So, I mean, I think that's what we're really seeing right now, is that you've got local communities, but now instead of having this fragmentation with mental health and dental, you know, trying to figure out how that comes together within the local community. So I think, you know, the 14, I think, is actually quite reflective of that, which I think is a good thing. We want to see those partnerships. And I think in the Portland area, you know, certainly it has its you know, unique environment. I think, you know, the folks there are doing the same, having the same discussions that, you know, everyone is around the state in terms of how can they actually build, you know, stronger partnerships to serve that population. And I think from the state perspective, we're saying that's great. We're still going to hold everybody accountable to that community engagement and to those outcomes. So nothing else changes. I think, again, from the value that we're trying to get from those dollars, it doesn't matter if there's going to be, you know, five or, you know, two, or, you know, we're looking at the same outcomes.
Okay, I'll just comment that when I voted for the bill, when we worked on the bill, my perception was there were going to be more. And again, the idea being closer to the community, more pods of innovation, more opportunities for people to try different things in different locales, and then share best practices. And so I would certainly hope that that's part of the plan.
And I guess my other piece of that, I mean, there's a balance of that, of just making sure that, you know, with our other evaluation component is the financial, and making sure that, you know, you're going to have certainly a large enough population to take on that risk. So I think, you know, in some communities who have, you know, not a large population, it's going to be difficult for them to have multiple. So, I mean, that's the other factor when you look around the state, and just in terms of how many, you know, CCOs can be in one area. I mean, we certainly have to look at that and take that into consideration.
Okay, quickly, and this is going to be Representative Greenlick, more of a comment. And I compliment you because you've done
a lot in a very short period of time. And this is an absolutely massive task. But it's kind of a cautionary tale. I'm going to use the analogy of ed reform, because my background's in education, where there's, they want education reform, and we want more achievement, and the people that are going to plan this achievement are these people over here, and there's no practitioners. There's no teachers on there. There's no kindergarten teachers. There's no nothing. It's people that are over here. And my cautionary tale to all of the CCOs is make sure that you have the boots on the ground people. If you want the savings in healthcare, have the people that are actually doing it every day, day in, day out, and having the patients come in and out. It's the same kind of thing, and I think there's frustration on the part of practitioners that people over here are calling the shots, just as there are from teachers, that people over here that have not been in a classroom in 25 years are also doing that. So it's more of a cautionary tale. But I do compliment you on how far you've gone in a very short period of time.
Thanks. And Rep. Doherty, I think that in the applications, what people have to demonstrate, the applicants have to demonstrate, is that they do have the boots on the ground, that they have the ability, the infrastructure, the network to get the job done. And just to piggyback on that, a comment about Representative Conger's question, I think we're at the beginning of this. And what the landscape is going to look like August 1 is probably going to change as this evolves and over the next several years. And I think we need to actually expect and encourage that, and I believe that that's what the framework of the legislation has really laid out, is the ability for organizations to form that meet those criteria, the ability for there to be single, double, triple, quadruple organizations in communities. And my sense is that it will change, and if the experience of the Oregon Health Plan is sort of any guide for that, the landscape in terms of the providers of service from when the Oregon Health Plan started in 92 looked very different 6-7 years later. I mean, dramatically different. And I think actually that's what we have to go into this as. If we're going to expect change and innovation, we've got to have a process that does that. And I believe this process is open to that, and we have to have some faith in, I think, the framework that you as legislators laid out, and let that process unfold.
Bruce, thank you guys very much. You've been doing a hell of a job, and we admire you. We're here to tell you all the ways you're doing it wrong. We also occasionally want to tell you how you're doing it right, and we really appreciate that.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call Lori Freeman up. Lori, as I'm sure all of you know, is our health counsel, and she's been studying what's going on at the federal level as well as the state level, and I've asked her, Representative Thompson and I have asked her to give us some cautionary tales about what might happen under alternative scenarios at the federal level in terms of our responsibility. So, Lori, thank you very much for your work and for coming here today.
Green members of the committee, Lori Freeman, Deputy Legislative Counsel. And I guess what I just wanted to go over is some of the state options that have become apparent under the federal regulations that were issued in March with respect to both the health insurance exchange and the Medicaid expansion. And these things all go in January of 2014, although, as you know, Exchange has to be up and running by October 2013. But that means that for any statutory changes that need to occur, that's going to have to happen in the 2013 session. So I wanted to highlight some of the policy issues that arise under these federal regs, and I know that the Health Insurance Exchange and the Oregon Health Authority, I'm sure, are working on their legislative policies. with respect to these, but I just wanted to highlight a few of those, especially the ones that might require a statutory change. And I'm not going to go through all of them. I gave you a list. I see that you're running behind, and I'm going to let you catch up.
Take your 15 minutes.
But one of the biggest issues, I think, facing the legislature as sort of the overseer of how this all comes together is this question of who makes the eligibility determinations. The regulations create this sort of umbrella group of programs called insurance affordability programs. They include purchasing insurance through the exchange, premium tax credits, cost-sharing reductions, and medical assistance. And the regs require there be a single streamlined application for all of those programs, meaning you should be able to file one application with the exchange, and if you're eligible for Medicaid, you're enrolled in Medicaid. If you're eligible for the exchange or premium tax credits, you get all of that. So what the regulations set out is options for states. They can either have the exchange make all of those determinations, or they can have the exchange make a determination of the premium tax credits, eligibility for participation in the exchange, cost-sharing reductions, and then an initial assessment of eligibility for Medicaid, in which case, they would have to transfer it to a Medicaid agency, which I'm not sure under our current structure whether that's DHS or the Oregon Health Authority, to make a determination of eligibility for Medicaid. So this is, you know, this has been sort of problematic ever since 2009, where we split out the eligibility determination function from OHA and left it in DHS. Now it's going to get even more complicated, so I wanted to get your thoughts going about how you think that ought to work out in the end. And I'm just going to skip through these. Of course, the certification of the qualified health plans, these are the plans that can are eligible to participate in the exchange. And Representative Thompson, I wanted to mention on the co-ops. The co-ops, I believe the idea behind the co-ops was to create a nonprofit health insurance option. And these are supposed to be consumer-governed and consumer-run private nonprofit. So I think the idea was just to make sure that these co-ops are introduced into the market. And the money that they get from the feds is they get loans, and they have to repay them. So it's not just straight-out federal grants. So certification of qualified health plans in current law, Oregon law, that you basically have left that up to the Oregon Health Insurance Exchange to figure out what the certification requirements are. The federal requirements set forth sort of a baseline, but then they give the states options for doing additional requirements, and I set those out in the document, some of the ones that were proposed in the federal regulations. And then finally, the benefit packages. And this gets kind of complicated, even more complicated, if that's possible, because you have these essential health benefits. And the essential health benefits under the Patient Protection Act have to be offered through the qualified health plans and through the Medicaid programs. The way the regulations have come out, you can have one set of essential health benefits for the Medicaid program and another one for the exchange program, but they have to be one of several benchmark plans that are identified in the regs. And let me just add, for the Medicaid program, this is only for the expansion population. So the people who aren't eligible today, you have to come up with a benchmark plan for those new people, but we can still have the prioritized list, assuming we get the waiver continued, for the regular Medicaid population. So a lot of choices
that
need to be made.
We can't have a prioritized list for the expanded population? Is that what you're saying?
Well, you could.
You need a waiver for that.
Well, we have to have the waiver to continue the prioritized list, but you could use, you can apply the same package for the expansion population as you currently have for the Medicaid population. So that's what they call a secretary-approved option, is you can just say, well, we're going to give all of our Medicaid population the same plan. But like I said, these are all policy choices that you all are going to have to make at some point. Some point. And then I just, a couple of small things. Another option that's available is to create a, is to provide Medicaid to individuals whose income is above the 133% of the federal poverty line. So the Medicaid expansion expands up to 133. States can go above 133. But there are questions about the federal Medicaid percentage for those. In other words, you get, for the initial 2 years, the Medicaid expansion population, the state gets 100% federal match, which ratchets down over time to 90%. If you want to go above 133%, you get the regular state match, which I think in Oregon is something like 63-37. And then finally, some changes regarding the families that receive temporary assistance to needy families. Back in 96, really, the Medicaid program was delinked from a lot of the cash assistance programs. And, but Oregon still uses all of the old TANF requirements for families to get the Medicaid related to needy families. So there are some changes, and I've listed them in the document, and I can talk to you about them further, but those are a couple of things that are going to require statutory changes. And then obviously just rolling all of this into our current statutory framework is going to take a lot of just changes to our Chapter 414, our medical assistance program. So I wanted to give everyone a heads up that that's coming down the pike, and you'll have some policy decisions to make.
Well, Lori, the real question for us, and I'm glad the committee's been here to think about it, is how do we coordinate with the exchange and OHA in terms of their legislative package and whatever else we need? I mean, we need to be thinking by the September meeting about what it is we're going to need to wrap around whatever it is they're doing. I mean, is there some way, I know as council, they'll be talking to you as well, and how do we get input to make sure there's not things missing that we need to be preparing for the next session?
Representative Greenlick, I really don't know. But I think it's really this, you know, like I said, the first issue about who's going to take charge on making these determinations and processing these applications is really complicated in light of the way our current statutory structure is laid out. So I don't know, you might want to have the committee come before you and talk about what efforts they're making to try to coordinate, or because at this point I don't know, I haven't seen their concepts.
I think the issue is that they're going to be making their plans at the administrative level for how do we run the exchange and how do we do transformation. So the question is, how do we make sure that there aren't statutory requirements? I mean, are you going to be advising them to say, well, all right, if you make this determination, this statute is going to need to be changed to support that?
Chair Greenlick, yeah, that would be my job. Is in an ideal world, they'll tell me what the policy, somebody will tell me what the policy is, and I'll make sure that our statutes do that.
I wonder if we should sort of do some coordination with the exchange and OHA and
I think
council.
It's beyond wondering. I think it's pretty important that we do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you guys take some lead in making sure, we're involved in that to make sure? I mean, the last thing we want is somebody to show up in May and say, oh, we forgot. We need, we're going to do this. We already did this, in fact, but it's in violation of these other statutes, and we try and scramble.
It would be even worse if Lori says, I warned you guys, and you did nothing. No, that would even be worse. So.
Well, that's why she's here.
I know.
Well, are there any questions? Lori, I mean, thank you very much, because I think this, we like the extent to which we can do this in advance saves us a ton of problems during session. Session is not the time to do this.
Right. Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming. Jim, you want to take over the gavel?
Okay.
Now we come to the hard part of the agenda. The co-chair will take over.
Yep.
This is really important to you and Lori and keep those guys.
Good, good.
It's great.
Okay, next we're going to hear the community perspective on CCO implementation or examples thereof. And I expect this to be the exciting part of today's hearing. First up, I'm going to call Jeff Hetherington from Family Care. You're the kickoff act, so you've got to really make it good, you know.
Warm up act.
Good morning, Chair Thompson and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Hetherington. I'm the president of the Family Care Health Plans. We are a Medicare HMO operation. I've been in business since 1985. We've evolved through a number of iterations of managed care here in the state of Oregon. Began as a physician care organization back in 1985 and 1994 when the Oregon Health Plan came into effect. We then took over as a full HMO type operation, and now we're transitioning once again into the CCO model. I would say in some respects they are just evolutionary. As they have moved along, we have seen a lot of good evolution as we moved. One of the things that Family Care has learned along the way is that it's been an interesting evolution, I would say, that trying to keep both the patients cared for and the providers in place. One of our key duties, of course, is to make sure that there's adequate access. And that really means that you have to take care of the practitioners that are out there. And that's probably been one of our longest term efforts, is to make sure that the private practice physicians and nurse practitioners feel like they are being well served, taken care of in a way that doesn't put a lot of burdens on top of them as they go along. We were one of the, in fact, we were the first plan to ever capitate our primary care and our specialty physicians. Took, you know, one of the big burdens off of them. That was the effort of having to call for referrals and having to get permission from the insurance company every time they want to do something. And we still do a lot of our contracts on a capitated basis. At one time, and it's gotten a lot more difficult, we actually had the hospitals capitated for their services. And at that point, it was an entirely vertically capitated system. And so patients could move right through the system without the permission or interference, however you want to look at it, of the insurance arm, because the providers could talk to each other as to what was most appropriate in the system. As you grow, that gets to be a little difficult because you can't keep your patients all in one network. They do tend to wander around, particularly in multiple hospital communities. Family care is unique in that it has, in the past, integrated dental care into its program. We were a dental and physical care provider in the early 90s until the state made a decision to separate dental care out of the Oregon Health Plan system. And then we took on the mental health, and we're the only health plan that has a fully integrated mental health program, and I've had that since 1996. One of the things we learned along the way with that is that requires a lot more than just your standard operation as an insurance company. It really involves having to get into the social area. And about 5 years ago, we developed a program called our service coordination. The name I've heard placed on it now is called Navigators. But our service coordinator program actually brings together both the practitioners and the clients in a way that hasn't been done before. You all hear about the patient-centered primary care homes. It's very hard for a lot of private practice physicians and nurse practitioners to fully implement something like that because the resources just aren't there for the smaller practices. And so what we do with our service coordination program is we have provided a service to the practitioners wherein they can make a one-stop call for mental health services, for social services, transportation services, whatever the client needs. And either they or we will make sure that the transfer is made seamlessly for the patient to get them into services that the practitioner wouldn't have readily available services for. And that has worked quite well, particularly for the practitioners. They like that ability to have, you know, ready answers for the things that their patient needs. The other thing we do through that program is to put together, we have a database that we watch very carefully, patients' behavior. And when we see people sort of going out of the grid, either through multiple visits to emergency rooms, if they're going into what we call the polypharmacy behaviors, then we can intervene directly with the patient and get them into the services that they need. We found, you know, some of them are drug-seeking. Some of them who use emergency rooms simply don't have child care. We can help them get child care. Sometimes they don't have transportation. And sometimes, frankly, they just aren't capable of doing proper planning. And then our service coordinators get into the process of helping them with that. All of that being said, that has really put us in a very good position as we go forward into the CCO model of having an integrated program. We feel like we've, you know, been doing that for a good 5 years, and there's a lot more that we can be doing. And with what's on the pike, I think we're family care is very ready to move into the CCO world. We do have we are a not-for-profit organization. So we do have a community board. We have six community members. We have three private practitioners on our board at the present time. We've extended some invitations out to other private practitioners, both in the mental health field and in the dental field, to come onto the board so that we have a good representation from all of the disciplines that we will be working with in the future, and we are bringing on some more community members to meet the requirements of the current law. We do have some concerns as we move forward. One is, frankly, how ready the state is to move forward here. We have some deadlines, as you heard from Dr. Goldberg, of a contract on June 15th. We certainly hope we can see it soon. because a lot of parts of that contract are not available. The rates that we will be working with are not available, or is the global budget. And this has caused us some concern because we have to be ready to go on August 1st, and it's a little hard to do our planning and get properly ready for that when the materials still aren't available for what I would call basic business operations, and the contract being the biggest part of it. The other part we're concerned about, of course, is the rules will not be ready until the 1st of July, and we are really hoping that that doesn't upset the planning that we've done in terms of signing contracts and accepting rates at that point, because we don't want the rules to suddenly put different burdens on us that we have not been prepared for. But all in all, I think it's been a very busy process, I will say that, and I'm sure the other plans will testify to this, to the same thing, but we feel like, particularly in the Portland metropolitan area, we're ready to go. We do have some business in Eastern Oregon and on the coastal areas, which we'll be doing also, and we look forward to starting later this summer.
Any questions?
No.
Yes, please.
Oh, no. your hand was up first, Representative Boyle.
One of my biggest concerns is that is our approach to integrating behavioral health care, because you know, it's important that one of the greatest cost drivers is not addressing behavioral mental health care needs, and if we come at that through just a physical health care lens with behavioral health as an adjunct, it's just not going to work. But again, the opportunity for cost savings and better health outcomes if we address those issues are tremendous. So you brought up how you've been integrating these for a fairly long time. Can you talk a little bit more about how your navigators integrate the behavioral and physical health care?
Well, they're pretty much of a guide. One of the things I didn't cover, but I'll talk a little bit about the navigators. The navigators are a ready source of information to either the primary care and mental health or the primary care in physical health, so that if either has a question of, well, where do we send this patient, the navigator can answer that question and help, you know, move the patient to the services they need. One of the things we have been working with for the past couple of years, and we certainly don't have it smoothly operating, is to attach the physical health providers directly to a mental health provider, so that they have a partner within that process. The situation you run into, of course, is the patient really does need to bond to whatever practitioner they're working with. So we're still trying to figure out how we make that system work without trying to lock the patient into a provider that they don't really have a good fit. And so, you know, we've seen a lot of transfers, but at least the benefit of attaching the two providers together has been to actually get to know what the other side of the care situation is like. Now, one of the things we found when we really started getting into integration is that physical providers and mental health providers actually don't have any relationship with each other. They don't talk to each other. And so, you know, that has been one of our focuses going forward, is just getting them to understand what each other does. They don't learn this really in school, and the best way to learn it is through a decent relationship where they actually have time to just sit down and talk beyond just the patient transfers.
Great, thank you.
Representative Conger.
Two questions, but before I even ask the question, the CCO's applications are currently public information, right?
I guess part of them are.
Okay. Well, if I ask anything that is not public, it's unintentional, so okay. Obviously know that I'm not trying to
right.
pry into that. So Your family cares application, you said there are three areas. So you've got the Tri-County area, it sounds like, or the Portland Metro, and then you have some in Eastern Oregon and some on the coast.
Correct.
Are those, or are you planning for those to be separate CCOs or all under one umbrella? And second part of the question is, could you give me a sense, and I know this is not your decision, but you probably have some kind of sense of how much total budget that would mean in terms of people served. And maybe the better question is people served. I don't know, but...
Right. Because of the community nature of the intent of the law, what we have done is set up separate corporations under our umbrella for each of the communities, and so they will have their own community boards that will mirror what the law requires, and they'll be locally controlled. And then we will provide the administrative services for each of those CCOs and be, you know, part of those operations. So that answers your first question. With regard to what the global budgets look like, I can take a wild guess for all of those areas, probably somewhere in the range of $150 to $200 million a year. And that sort of depends on, like I said, we haven't really seen the numbers yet. And we've seen three different numbers. Our current rates that we're getting, the templates we filled out, and then the global budget number, and they really didn't relate well to each other. So we're sort of guessing as to where we are given our current population, which is about 60,000 clients.
One quick follow-up. Are each of the corporations that you're forming, first of all, how many? Is it three?
Three, yes.
Okay. And are they separately capitalized, so each have reserves based on the requirements of?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
To take Representative Hoyle's question a little further, one of my concerns is the problematic issue of tucking drug and alcohol addiction treatment into the middle of primary care, which has not traditionally been there. Any thoughts on how that might interface in your kind of program?
Well,
obviously you're going to be evaluated eventually on the success of that part as well as the rest of the program.
Drug and alcohol treatment has been part of our contract since we started with the Oregon Health Plan. That would be sort of the third leg of mental, physical, and the alcohol and drug, although the alcohol and drug really attaches very strongly to the mental health side of the equation. And that's where we have pretty much placed it, you know, with our mental health providers. The physical health providers may see the problem, but they generally do not treat it. We move that into the A&D area and mental health area.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure we'll be talking again. Next, we will talk with the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative, Janet Meyer, Dr. George Brown, and Cindy Becker. And because there are three of you, you do not have three times the time. Just a thought.
I don't even have a microphone, so.
Oh, well, it's a start. We're getting somewhere. Yeah. And you may proceed.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Thompson, members of the committee. For the record, I am Dr. George Brown, Chair of the Tri-County Collaborative Board of Directors. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today. As you may recall from previous testimony before your committee, the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative emerged from a group of private and public organizations addressing a single complicated question. Can we together improve the quality of care and the care experience of Oregon Health Plan members and do it for less money? For the last several months, the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative's participating organizations, Adventist, Care Oregon, Central City Concern, Clackamas County, Kaiser Permanente, Legacy Health, Multnomah County, Oregon Health and Science University, Providence, Tuolumne Health, and Washington County have been exploring how to create an integrated regional system of care for the 216,000 Oregonians who receive services through the Oregon Health Plan in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. The Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative's approach to partnering with communities to improve and coordinate services has emerged from hundreds of hours of work with local community members, behavioral health providers, primary care providers, social service agencies, community-based organizations, consumer groups, business groups, dental providers, health advocates, health insurers, and the Oregon Health Authority. This broad outreach has been and will continue to be a hallmark of our work. The Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative's participating organizations have established a new nonprofit public benefit corporation, and we are pursuing a 501c3 status. We have launched a public process for soliciting applications to fill out the board of directors for this new organization. Board application information can be found on the collaborative's website at tricountycollaborative.org. It should be noted that we plan to broaden the scope of legislatively mandated positions on the board, and we are recruiting the following: a primary care physician, a specialist physician, a nurse or nurse practitioner in primary care, a dentist, a mental health provider, a chemical dependency provider, and two community members at large. We have hired an interim leadership team led by Janet Meyer, the interim CEO, and she's to my left. Janet's team developed and submitted the Tri-County Collaborative's CCO application on the 30th of April and financial materials on May 14th. The interim leadership team is also building internal processes, executing agreements, and establishing relationships across the community that will be necessary to operate a CCO by 1 August. In a moment, Janet will speak in more detail about her team's vision. There are many challenges facing us. However, the clear commitment to the vision that participating organizations and the broader community have demonstrated makes me very optimistic about our ability to achieve something bold, innovative, and successful. The members of the collaborative have all signed an agreement that contains a number of provisions, including financial commitment. One organization whose involvement we valued highly was unable to attest to all the provisions, specifically an agreement not to pursue a separate CCO in the Tri-County service area. Unfortunately, that meant that family care could not continue to be a member of the collaborative. We are saddened by this development, as we believe that collaboration and not competition is the solution to healthcare transformation. And we remain ready and willing to have family care join us at the table again if they can make the same commitments the other organizations have made. We are only at the beginning of our journey. We are committed to engendering a healthy, thriving, engaged population, to eliminating health disparities, and to bending the cost curve so that we may have the resources to cultivate healthy communities for generations to come. Again, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you all today, and I welcome any questions that you might have.
We hold the questions until we have here from all three of them. Okay, thank you. Janet?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for having us. My name is Cindy Becker, and I am the Director of Health, Housing, and Human Services for Clackamas County. I'm also Secretary of the Board for the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative. a couple of things I want to start out with. One is my new favorite quote, which is, change is good, you go first. And so I think what's happening now is we are all undergoing change. And I think, though, that there's been some assumptions that the Tri-County Collaborative has made a lot more decisions than we have to date. We really have started meeting weekly starting in December, so 6 months ago, and we have put in an application to CMMI, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and then we have responded to the department's OHA's request for applications. So we have really been focusing on governance. We have really been focusing on how do we build relationships, quite honestly, that haven't been there before. And, you know, most entities of this size would really do this over a couple of years, and we've been doing it over really a few months. And to be honest with you, it's gone quite well. We really are working together. I think we have, well, I know we have very similar vision and principles. The counties are full partners at the table. I'm really excited about that. And I also wanted to respond a little bit to Representative Hoyle, just in terms of the value add that we bring really is in the behavioral health area. And the whole issue of integration is one of the top five priorities of the collaborative. And we are working really at the local level to make this happen. The collaborative is big, as Representative Conger talked about. But the healthcare delivery is happening in local communities. It's happening with individuals who are living in those communities. It's going to be happening with the providers. It's happening with the practitioners. Behavioral health integration is a huge issue. In Clackamas County, what we have done is we have placed mental health providers in our fully qualified health clinics. We've also, for individuals who have severe and persistent mental illness, we have done the reverse. We have placed nurse practitioners into those clinics. And so we are looking at a variety of different opportunities for us to do things differently. The Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative is more or less a virtual organization, and it is looking at how do we build that regional infrastructure. But the health care delivery is going to happen community by community. We've been going out and talking with communities. We've done presentations in Multnomah and in Washington. We're also doing one actually tonight in Clackamas County, because we don't want the Tri-County Collaborative to be seen as Portland-centric. Not that there's anything wrong with Portland, but we really need to spread out, you know, that we have a lot of rural areas in the Tri-County area, and so we really are trying to do outreach. We have just launched the application process for our Community Advisory Council, and we are seeking membership of about 20 individuals. 51% of those have to be consumers in accordance with state statute, but we're also looking at community providers and community leaders. We would like the Community Advisory Council to be representative of communities and not just people who are partaking of the services. So we really are trying to cast a wide net and going out and speaking with individuals and providers and groups. And to be honest with you, we have a long way to go. We're really just starting, but the issues that you've brought up, the concerns you've brought up, the questions are valid. We're asking them ourselves, and we are, now that we've got the application behind us, we're going out and doing the type of outreach that we had hoped to do and that you would hope that we would do.
Thank you. Co-Chair Thompson, members of the House Interim Committee on Health Care. For the record, I am Janet Meyer, Interim CEO of the Tri-County Medicaid Collaborative. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you a little bit about the progress we've made to date. Dr. Brown and Cindy gave you some background on our history, our mission, our values. I want to talk a little bit about sort of what we're doing on the ground in the trenches today to prepare for 8-1. I think the best way to describe our work day at the Collaborative is to draw a comparison to duck football. As many of you know, the Ducks use a method called the no-huddle offense. Their game is fast. The opponent is often on their heels, exhausted and disoriented. It's proven to be a highly effective tool for the Ducks. At the Collaborative, our method can best be described as no-huddle health reform. Move fast, question everything, and exhaust your opponents. The conundrum in this is that most of us at this large table, known as the Collaborative, are the very opponents we are trying to defeat. The providers, the health plans, the delivery systems, the counties, all of us are really opponents in one way or another. We're all being required to transform and reform our business and our practice. We all agree it needs to be done, and most of us are truly delighted to participate in the disassembly and reassembly of this system. But every one of us, without exception, might get our ox gored at least once during this process. So how do we see this really working? Our principles that have come to us from our sponsors, our collaborators. The system must be member and provider driven, not health plan driven. Provider community is broadly defined: community service providers, addictions, physical health, mental health. The system of care must be regional, and it must be both regional and a system. Models that utilize non-traditional health workers are going to be critical to our success, and we must become hospitalization prevention experts. We simply can't afford the old model anymore. Some of the strategies that our provider partners have identified include integrated community care teams that are regionalized and built around community outreach workers connected to patient-centered primary care homes. We're working on standardizing the transition process. Anytime a member transitions in care from hospital to primary care or from other settings, we should have a warm handoff back to the primary care home to ensure success for that transition. We're focusing on developing a community-wide health IT system with interoperability. Wish us luck on that one. And then focusing on payment reform, because if you really want to change the way care is delivered, you need to change the way you're paying for it. So we're working on some innovative payment reform approaches. We also recognize that a CCO is not just about creating new programs. It's also about making sure that regular care does not fail. No one should end up in the emergency department because of a defect in our system. The Collaborative has worked hard to be one of the first CCO applicants to release our Community Advisory Council Charter. And our goal is ambitious, but our recruitment has begun, and we want to seat our advisory council at the same time we seat the full board of directors. Dr. Brown and Cindy mentioned our active recruitment of our remaining board positions. We see a key ingredient here in both the board and the Community Advisory Council working together, and that it must be broad-based. Tri-County is not one homogenous community. There's a big difference between Gaston and Gresham, between Sherwood and St. John's, and we need to reflect all the communities we serve in the Tri-County area. In the end, our biggest challenge is how we balance disruptive innovation with maintaining stable access. We're charged with dramatically changing the way our community delivers, pays for, and experiences care. At the same time, we cannot allow our efforts to disrupt the current access to care. We can't be another Facebook. We can't move fast and break things. We don't have a license to break things. We're in the healthcare business. We have to move forward with all due speed and be cautious at the same time. So how do we balance the risks of too much, too fast, not enough, soon enough? We don't have the luxury to wait, and yet we can't suffer the consequences of disruption. We appreciate the work the Oregon Health Authority staff is doing with us. They're pushing us to transform, but they're recognizing that we need to be successful and that the cost for failure would be very high with CCOs. So we're working very closely to, again, focus on stability and focus on changing the dynamics of the system. And we ask that the legislature continue to keep that balance in mind as we move forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
First of all, I think profoundly insightful about working on governance and building trust first. I don't know how else you could do this, and I can't imagine the challenge it must be to have these competitors who are slicing up a pie sitting at the same table and working on collaborating and trusting each other with decision-making authority about that budget. That's really impressive. And just a comment, I think the fact that that's occurring is probably a victory for the intent of the legislation, which was to force collaboration. My question is really about one of Dr. Brown's comments. And this isn't about competition, it's about collaboration. I think I agree up to a point, but could you elaborate a little bit on why you think that competition is bad?
Chair Thompson, Representative Conker. I think if you look at the healthcare industry as a whole, competition has not proven to lower costs. In fact, competition has caused a medical arms race, if you will. If healthcare system A has a new robot for minimally invasive surgery, then health system B has to have two robots. I think if you look at some of the writings that have occurred across the country, and most notably in McAllen, Texas, where on a per capita basis there's the highest number of cardiovascular surgeons. It's just coincidence that the highest incidence of open heart surgery happens to occur in that community. So with that in mind, and also the very daunting fact that the available dollars are the available dollars. The money is the money. And that with evidence-based healthcare really being held out before us as the standard we should meet, it became very apparent to competing organizations that we really needed to change the way that we're doing things. And that is to collaborate and not to have needless competition. Now, there are some things that we can do to compete. We can compete on the quality of our services. We can compete on the quality of the experience of our services. And I think that is a good thing, but I also think that the greater good here is to come together to provide a higher level of community health care based on evidence-based medicine, evidence-based practice, and also to look at the long term in terms of what is the health of the population.
Representative Doherty.
Hey, this is kind of a follow-up. This is very strange because I was going to ask the identical question as Representative Conger. But my concern is, I've got some grave concerns that one organization would have the entire Tri-County area because you've got a lot of people and you've got a lot of whatever. And my concern is whether what happens if you mess up? You've got everybody in the Tri-County area. So, I'm not quite sure that, and I came in at the end of your comment, but I was kind of surprised when it was a comment of having family care or whoever the organization go away. But I really do have some grave concerns that one organization could handle basically a vast majority of the Medicare, Medicaid, and Oregon Health Plan patients in the state of Oregon. I think there needs to be some competition. Not competition of, well, we're going to have an MRI machine here and an MRI machine here. That's coordination. But the idea of administering the programs to everyone is a big concern of mine.
Chair Thompson, Representative Doherty, your point is a good one. And, yes, the risks are very high. But I think the costs have been high and the outcomes have not been particularly stellar in terms of measuring the health of the population that the 11, 12 organizations provide care to. I think when you look at your concern around a monolith managing care for over 200,000 patients, when you look at it from the lens of a single organization and that causes you concern, I think that's reasonable. However, when you consider that these 200,000 patients frequently visit multiple systems in their quest for health care, that those individual systems are siloed from one another, not only do you not get the economies of scale and efficiency, you typically don't get improvement in health because you have multiple opinions, you have multiple points of entry, multiple medications with all their associated complications. And so from our standpoint, this large organization with its difficulties because of size provides that economy of scale. And really, our thrust is to make full use of our ability to coordinate care, not only physical care, but behavioral health, oral health, and to be able to coordinate some of the social requirements that really are isolated from caring for this medically underserved population. So we think that coming together, sharing our best practices, trying as best we can, as fast as we can, to integrate our health information systems and to coordinate with community organizations and to push care as far out in the communities as we can, closest to the patient, closest to that community, and at the lowest cost, is in our mutual best interest.
And I appreciate your comment. I still have some grave concerns over that.
Well, we do too. This is new, and it's an uncharted course that we're taking, and so if I'm wearing my chief executive officer hat of Legacy Health, there are some things that I'm doing that are against the business model of the current healthcare health system model, but I do think it's in our best long-term interest.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. So a couple of us had a chance to meet with you all this morning before committee and brought up the question of players in nurses, OMA, ONA, who have some concerns. And literally, as we're sitting here, we got yet another one of those letters from another group who has concerns. And so I'm kind of curious who else is out there feeling disenfranchised by this process, because this group came from Women's Healthcare Associates. The associates sent this out to us this morning. And I agree with the concerns that, you know, is this too big? And then the other piece of that is not just too big to provide the actual care, but what happens to doctors and healthcare practitioners who want to participate in a CCO but don't like your governance model or don't like, you know, what the final product looks like, and how do they then participate in the metro area, tri-county area, if they don't like what you've put together but still want to be able to serve and provide these patients? So I'm kind of curious what that looks like at the end of the day, and how participants who don't want to go participants don't want to be involved or felt like they were disenfranchised in the process, and now they're kind of out here in the dark, but they still want to provide to that patient population, and what's your thought around that?
Well, that potentially could be a challenge. I think one of the challenges for community providers that have not been involved in this process is the unknown and the fear to their business model, their existence, et cetera. I will tell you that our model of care team was very broad-based. Probably close to 75 or 80 individuals from the community representing all shades of practitioners looking at what would the ideal system of care be. But we are also very cognizant of the fact that we need every primary care provider that we can to provide the care to our community. And if our estimate is that we have inadequate numbers now, and we need to look at how we can use advanced practice practitioners to extend that care. Our hope is that as we get past understanding governance and get past the application process and finally get to delivering a model of care in the future, that practitioners will welcome what we're doing, since I think at the very heart of it all, every practitioner wants to make sure that they improve the state of health of the members in the Oregon Health Plan. The challenge for us is we have an extremely short timeline, we have a Herculean task, doing something quickly but comprehensively is sort of antithetical to accomplishing either. But I'm very pleased with the progress that we've made thus far.
Representative Cowan?
No, I didn't have a question.
Okay.
Thank you. And then Rep. Hoyle is raised right now.
Oh, Representative Hoyle. I didn't see you.
No, we get mistaken for each other all the time.
So I can understand how.
Yeah. Hiding behind me.
Yeah. So I thank you, and thank you for addressing the concerns of people who, you know, again, valid concerns about practitioners, primary care practitioners wanting to be at the table, and I know you addressed it, Dr. Brown, in your original testimony, and thanks for addressing that again. I'm going to ask a similar question to what I asked Mr. Hetherington, which is, as we're moving forward, and again, cost savings is in integration of care, behavioral, physical health, dental health, you know. Cindy, I think you're in a very good position to discuss. How do you address social determinants and their impact on health care and health outcomes? And again, your position with Clackamas County, I think, puts you in a good place to talk about that. But I think it's critical and important, and we can't leave that aside. So could you address that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle. We know that people, the majority of someone's health is not determined by their visit to the doctor's office. If you don't have a place to live, if you're living in poverty, if you don't have a job, it doesn't matter what treatment you get in the doctor's office, if you even go to a doctor's office. And so part of the conversation and part of the model of care conversation is really bringing in those other social service, social support providers, housing providers, a variety of outreach folks. And looking at how do we change the way we deliver services. So two things. One is an investment in prevention. You know, we haven't invested a lot in prevention. And one of the reasons is because we didn't get paid for it. You know, you get paid when someone comes to your office and you provide treatment. You don't get paid for keeping someone out of your office. And so with the CCO, with the waivers, we're really excited about the opportunity to invest in prevention. We're excited about the opportunity to bring services out to the community. We met with some of our ambulance folks in the county, and they said 29% of their medical calls are for non-emergent services. Yet, when they get the call, they got to send out the fire truck and, you know, everybody out there. And oftentimes, it doesn't take very much to help people stay in their homes. It could be learning how to use some of your medication, or if you have asthma. And so it's bringing folks. You don't need to see a primary care doc for that, quite honestly. So how do you, and I think Dr. Brown talked about the extenders, how do you bring people out to communities where people are? Looking at, you know, what are the other issues that are impacting when people go into the emergency room who don't need emergency room care? Oftentimes, people who go there do have Oregon Health Plan, and they're using the emergency room as their primary care resource because there is an access in the community. So how do we invest in whether it's federally qualified centers or other services? How do we work with primary folks in the emergency room? We may not be able to prevent them from coming the first time or from being seen, but we should be able to prevent them from going the second time. And so that is by linking them in the community and linking them with housing resources. Linking the other issue that's really big for the populations that we serve is social isolation. A lot of the individuals that we serve with mental health or addictions issues are socially isolated, and so they don't know where to go, so they go to the emergency department. So it's how do we connect people out in the community, and again, how do we connect those resources? One of the things that we've been doing in behavioral health, really for the past couple of years, but probably more so this year, is peer supports. We are giving training to people who have mental health and addictions who are in recovery, and they are providing services to individuals who have similar issues. We've just contracted with this very cool group called Iron Tribe. These are individuals who have been in through our jail systems who have addictions issues, and they now are providing services to the very same population. So it's how are we best utilizing all the resources of our community to provide community health? Not just going to the institutions, not just going to the physical health. Not that that's not important, but unless we're wrapping around those other services, unless we're making sure that people aren't going to jail because they don't have community services, making sure that families are able to stay more functional is something that we're really taking the physical health and mental health and wrapping around the social supports to make that happen. And I think through the CCO, we're being given an opportunity to fund things in non-traditional ways so that we can get there. It's going to be a long process, but it's also not rocket science. You know, you all know what the issues are that are facing your communities or facing your families. And so to be able to bring this together is something that we're pretty excited about.
Thank you. Okay. Include this panel. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The fact that you people have 50% of the Medicaid population in your area shouldn't be any pressure. Yeah. Okay, next up we have Dr. Robert Dannenhofer from Douglas County CCO. And while he is coming up, I will put everybody on warning. Following him will be Greater Oregon Behavioral Health. Understand we have Dr. Powers on video conference from Enterprise, and that she can see us right now, but we are not watching her. So if she needs another cup of coffee, now is the time to get it, because we'll be beaming her in. So
Jim, we're running pretty far behind at the
yes.
moment as well. So I think we really need to
speed it up.
Make sure people.
Yes.
I will help you get ahead of your schedule.
Thank you.
So, Chairman Thompson, for the record, my name is Robert Dannenhofer. So in Douglas County, there is good news. Together, we've brought together the doctors, the dentists, the hospitals, the county mental health, county public health, our FQHC, and our drug and alcohol people to form up our health alliance. This is a group that we hope will be the first CCO in the state. I think we're doing a good job. We have a shared governance model. We have had a tremendous amount of input. Representative Thompson would be glad to know that the doctors and dentists have no trouble giving me and give me plenty of input. There's some really good stuff here. I think the community has really rallied around the idea to control the stuff locally. Our community advisory board has had a lot of enthusiasm, and we have far more applicants than we have seats on the board. I think there is growing enthusiasm for alternative payment models. People need to be worked through. They need to work through this. They need to understand what's going on. But I think once they understand what we're talking about in alternative payment models, I think they get it. And I think the concept of improved population health is really catching on in the community. We have used in our community the idea that every kid who starts kindergarten should start kindergarten with no cavities in their mouth, all their immunizations, and normal vision. So to do that, that's a big systems process to screen every kid, to be sure that every kid has their eyes screened. If they don't pass their screening, to go to the eye doctor and actually get their glasses before they start school. That's a kind of two-minute presentation I can give that almost everybody gets, and I think we have a lot of enthusiasm there. There's stuff which isn't quite so good. Although I think the rules process has gone well, they've done very little to fix the leaking roof while we're working on this beautiful new facade here. For example, there's been an onerous hearings process that's really preposterous in the way we're doing it. The preposterous rules about sharing data on Medicare that we haven't seemed to fix as we're working on this new and great stuff. And then the rules are very prescriptive. As much as we said there's going to be lots of flexibility in what goes on, I think the degree of prescriptive nature of these rules is really very worrisome. For example, in the patient-centered primary care homes, they really fit well for a large clinic of 30 doctors. But in Roseburg, where you only have 4 pediatricians, many of the rules are not going to work in the rural areas. And I think the prescriptiveness of the rules is really quite worrisome. And then the really ugly part of what's going on there is this financial application. You know, we're asked to do a 5-year quarterly budget on what's going to go on, but we're not going to tell you exactly how many members you have, how much we're going to pay you, or what rules you're going to have to follow. And this has now made it nearly impossible. Our budget is going to be anywhere between $60 and $100 million. And to do a budget with that lack of clarity, that lack of detail on the inputs is really very worrisome. And finally, I think Senate Bill 1580 was really very clear about what the reserve requirements would be for MCOs who were going to be CCOs. And they seem to have really just ignored that and have come up with new reserve requirements, which are at least 10 times higher than what was prescribed in Senate Bill 1580. So I don't know where that's going to shake out in the end, but I will tell you that is really very worrisome. But overall, things are pretty good.
Thank you. Questions? Good job.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next up we have Greater Oregon Behavioral Health, Kevin Campbell, Dr. Liz Powers, who will be on video, and Chris Signer, who I presume is here.
And I think media will turn us on. Is that what they're going to do? Okay.
Good morning.
Proceed.
For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the CEO of Great Oregon Behavioral Health, or GOBI. We're located in the Dalles. Dr. Powers is only available. She was available until 10, and so I'm going to let her lead off our conversations. I think it's far more important that you hear how things are working.
We had her for a tenth of a second. Oh, there we go.
Well, she'll be with us in a minute.
Here we go.
Okay.
Good morning, Dr. Powers.
Good morning. You can see me. Can you hear me as well?
Yes, we can.
Yes.
I think it's far more important that you hear how things are going in places like Enterprise and Burns than to hear me babble on about how well things are going from GOBI's perspective. I will tell you that we're building a strong network through partnerships with good, solid partners like Advantage Dental, like the Umpqua Health Alliance, with ODS, and with Care Oregon. And I can tell you the criteria for those partnerships
is that a CCO has to be local enough to be relevant and big enough to be solvent. But we have to have the ability for local ownership, we have to have the ability for local voice and local governance, and we have to have the ability to own the CCO in the future, not have those of us that are owning it today clinging on to that ownership. It has to be a community asset. We believe we've achieved that through those partnerships. We are have worked on four of the 14 applications that were submitted by April 30th, and I can tell you rural Oregon is absolutely ready to move ahead. With that, Dr. Powers.
Dr. Chair Thompson, Powers. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Liz Powers. I'm from Wallowa County in the town of Enterprise. I work at Winding Waters Clinic, which is a rural health clinic and serves as a safety net out here in Wallowa County. And we are very excited about the CCOs moving forward. And I think what has been the biggest catalyst for our community was Gobi coming to talk to us and getting us started thinking about these things. And since then, we've had some community meetings. We don't have a governance board and we don't have a community advisory council, but what I can say is we're a group of people who are very interested in moving forward with collaboration. I think we have come up with a name for that. We're trying to be the Wallowa County Health Improvement Collaboration. And so far, the invested stakeholders are providers, so all the providers in the community, the hospital, our mental health department, the public health department, and the county commissioners. Who is missing from the table has also been pretty apparent from the beginning, and we're working to bring those people in. That includes dental services, alternative medicine, the social services here, including DHS, Head Start, community connections, building healthy families, public safety, which is also very important in community health, and patients. And we have some patients who are now engaged in joining us. We, from the beginning, wanted to be really clear before we made any contracts with CCOs about what our goals were and what is our vision. And we tend to aim pretty high, and so our vision and our goal is 100% access and zero disparity for Wallowa County as far as access to healthcare and also health outcomes. So what is it going to take to make a CCO successful in Wallowa County? I think that collaboration piece is huge. I think one of the things that we're struggling with as we meet as a group of community healthcare providers and people who are really invested in this success is that it's not something that you can do in a rural community for just a group of people. You have to make changes for the entire community, and so it's problematic for us that this is right now only the Medicaid and OHP population. And so in order for this to be successful long term, this needs to expand to include public employees, it needs to expand to include Medicare, and it needs to expand to include private pay as well. So when we're talking about making changes, we're talking about how do you change the communication channels, the collaboration, the delivery systems for everyone in the communities, not just for our Medicaid population. I think the other thing that we're a bit concerned about is something that's right along those same lines, which is that you can't change how you provide care within a practice for just a small subset of your population. And so we, as the Rural Health Center and as sort of the safety net clinic for the community, we're certified as a Tier 3 patient-centered medical home. We're definitely moving forward with this, but there are some other smaller providers in the community that are really struggling to do it for a small percentage of their patients. And I worry about what that's going to do to affect patient choice if this isn't something that those providers are going to be able to do. So I think for the CCOs to be successful, they have to absolutely value primary care and collaboration, and there has to be a large enough capitated payment to make that worthwhile. But it also is going to need to really prioritize transformation and not just pay for us doing the same things we used to do. So really, over and above getting people to play, getting people incentivized to make those sort of transitions. I heard a comment from the gentleman from Douglas County about how some of the rules for the patient centered primary care home might be onerous for rural communities, and we haven't found that to be true at all. We're pretty frontier out here in Wallowa County, and
Tara, can I get you to wrap it up as soon as possible? We're running out of time.
Sure. I can actually just stop there if you have any questions.
Okay. Are there any quick questions? Sorry, I mean, we'll be having these discussions again at least in September, so we probably won't invite you back, but...
Just quickly.
Yes.
So, Doctor, you're saying that you haven't found the rules to be onerous, that the process is working. Do you have any concerns with the rules as they're laid out and how you're able or not able to move forward?
It's less the rules and it's more the financial risk. So we're doing it because we feel it's the right thing to do. We've already seen it change outcomes with our populations. We've substantially dropped our ER visits in our county. So it's not doing it. It's being able to stay afloat as a business while you're doing it with the current resources.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Chris, do you have any final comments?
Yeah, thank you. My name's Chris Signer. I'm the director of Symmetry Care, a nonprofit community mental health program in Burns, Oregon, Harnett County. Also a board member of GOBI, so I've been involved in this. And in Harnett County, we actually started getting together several months ago. And, I mean, in our communities as small, and the doctor's talking about that, we actually know each other really well. I mean, my kids are friends with the doctor's kids and physical therapist kids. So when we got together, we said, let's look at the most highest Medicaid utilizers in our community. And let's think a little bit differently about how we can treat them in more of this CCO approach, which is we're gonna get together and not just in our separate ways and maybe talk by phone. We're actually going to meet in a room, and we're going to take a case, and we're going to talk to that person and get their permission, first of all, and say, look, you know, things are not working well. You're utilizing the ER, or you're utilizing mental health or other services in our community, and it just doesn't seem to be getting better. So what can we do differently? How could we think about these cases differently? And that really was the impetus behind what we started doing there, and that's what we really want the CCOs to back. We want that kind of... We're kind of excited about what you guys have got going here. I mean, I think it works for us in rural communities better because it's going to improve the health care. So, a real simple example is we looked at somebody that had severe obesity and mobility problems and mental health issues on top of that, and we said, you know, how can we think a little bit differently about treating that person? So we go to the hospital, and this is a group of a hospital nursing supervisor, the doctor, myself, public health, and a hospital discharge planner, and said, well, you know what this person needs is to be admitted, and maybe admission for 60 days, which is almost unheard of, with no reimbursement for that. And we'll try to then apply some interventions like physical therapy and nutritionist and mental health services to go with that and see if we can help that person along. And so those are the kinds of plans that we actually developed. And the hospital said, okay, we'll do it. You know, they know they're not going to get paid. You know, mental health is not, I don't know how we're going to get paid, you know, for doing something like that. Yeah, and so, you know, that's not the issue. And I hope the CCO is a way to sort of promote that type of programming. And so those are that plan actually exists for an individual in our community right now. And it's actually underway with the goal that person is potentially going to have bypass surgery. And the outcome we want is them to be mobile and be able to take care of their family. That's really what we're shooting for here. So, you know, that's just a real snapshot of what we're trying to do, but that's what we really want to see promoted. You know, the other thing Kevin asked me to talk about is what do we need out of the CCOs, and I guess this is for you guys. What we need is what you've talked about a lot, but it truly is a local control. We need to have that ability to make those decisions as practitioners in our communities. We need, and this is going to be a big one, is we're going to need assistance in all these different electronic medical records. Our medical record at Mental Health doesn't talk to the medical record at the hospital. That's got to get fixed. The CCOs are going to have some way when they put us all together that we can share that information, not because we fill out a HIPAA form and I have to call over, because when we have that integrated health record, I can look that person up and I can see what medications they're taking from the primary care physician, and they can see what medications our psychiatrist is prescribing. The flexibility in the funding, which has been promoted, but it actually has to continue. Another really important thing is, I think, a commitment on everybody's part to see this through, not go halfway with it. It has to go all the way. If this is our plan and this is what we agreed is best for healthcare in Oregon, we need to do that. And the last thing is to roll in the items that are left off the table: long-term care, indigent care, state hospitalization. You know, this is all about risk. You know, if you piece it out, the risk goes up. If you roll it in, the risk goes down, and we can do a better job. So that's my list. I'm being as quick as I can. Yeah. So
we'll have this conversation again, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. If I could simply close
quickly,
Mr. Chair, I think that it's very interesting the juxtaposition of the previous the metro area and the rural area. You can add the populations of Lake, Harney, Grant, Wallowa, Wheeler, Gillam, and Sherman counties together and come up with 1% of the state's population. So what Chris is saying about the need for local ownership is imperative in our success. And I just want to close by saying a bad outcome can happen anywhere in the state, and it can be devastating to the system in general, but it can be particularly devastating to a community. It's far better if we can prevent those bad outcomes than to try to address them in a reactive system rather than a prepared system.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Next up, we will hear from the rural hospitals, Sandra Reese and Jim Matz. And I'm going to do something very unpopular and ask you to hold it to about 2 minutes each.
Let us know. Thank you.
My co-chair ran way over on the first half. And
Oh, your nose is going to get longer and longer.
Proceed.
Thank you. I'm Sandy Reese. I'm the administrator at Lower Umpqua Hospital in Reedsport, Oregon. It's on the southern coast, and I've been there a little over 18 years as the administrator. I'll go right to our experiences with CCOs at this point. We have two medical clinics, one owned by the hospital, one independent in the hospital. We are the medical providers for the community. With the hospital also owns an ambulance service. And we know we embrace the CCO concept, and we all work very closely together and take care of all the people in Western Douglas County through our district. And we know we're not strong enough to stand alone financially. And so we went looking for partners, and it wasn't a particularly pleasant experience all the way through. We first approached our own county, Douglas County. We're on the western border of Douglas County, and approached the Roseburg Group through our county commissioner. And they, the group that was forming in Roseburg at the time, and because we're cost reimbursed, the group did not second the commissioner's motion that we join the group, be asked to the table, because we were cost reimbursed, and they thought we'd be too risky to add to their group. So we didn't pursue that much further because we did get a call from our representative with Care Oregon, and they asked us with the Gobi group to join with them, that they put in an application for our zip codes. And we were very pleased by this because we already work with Care Oregon. Both medical clinics like working with them, and Gobi has put clinicians into the clinics to work within in the clinic there, and the mental health workers there to work to meet the needs of our community. So we thought that they'd be good partners for us. So we've written a letter of support for their application. And right before applications were due, the group south of us, which is fairly competitive, they did come up and asked us to be in their group, and they've competed with us in the past, so that it is a concern for us. And so we resisted, and they said, well, just tell us and we'll walk away. And I said, thank you, please walk away. And they had submitted their application the day before claiming our zip codes and not talked to any of the community providers there. And so I just want to encourage you, and I know you are, trying to keep the levels local, the providers local, and not supporting some of this frenzy going on, I think, is thinly veiled competition, just market share, trying to get market share. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
Chair Greenlink and members of the committee, my name is Jim Mattis. I'm the president of Grand Run Hospital in La Grande, Oregon. I'm here to share with you an exciting development where 10 hospitals in Eastern Oregon are trying to put together a coordinated care organization together with our employed physicians and mid-level providers, and many of those hospitals are district hospitals, so that includes mental health, public health, and drug and alcohol services as well. We haven't had time because of the rush schedule to put together all the local networks that would fit into that regional system, but we envision an application being filed soon that will be a grassroots approach. And you heard from the Tri-County presentation this morning that they feel that local and provider-based is important, rather than an insurance company or some third party that is attempting to force change on the local community. This will be a local option that will represent all the interest of providers on a community basis.
Thank you. I look forward to your application.
When will it go in?
We're hoping within the next 30 days.
That's great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your time. Switching hats now, we're going to move to a presentation on clinical drug trials in Oregon. And that will be Eric Orwall, MD, and Sharon Brigner. And I would appreciate it if you could shorten it however you can, realizing.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Good morning. Thank you, Chairman Greenlink, and thank you, Chairman Thompson, and the other members of this committee for hosting this informational meeting and inviting our panel to talk about clinical trials here in Oregon. My name is Sharon Brigner, and I work for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and I'm also an emergency room on occasion on the weekends, on Saturdays, in my local hospital in Northern Virginia. I'm here to share with you a report that was recently released on clinical trials here in Oregon. You all should have this in front of you, and it. Before I do that, I want to show a very brief video, 1 minute and 50 seconds.
That's right.
Thanks, Debbie.
The path from understanding a disease to treating it is long, difficult, and expensive. To make sure prescription medicines are safe and effective for the patients who use them, the candidate drug must first go through rigorous research studies in humans, called clinical trials. A clinical trial team includes doctors and nurses, social workers, and other healthcare professionals, and is usually sponsored by biopharmaceutical companies, medical institutions, foundations, or voluntary groups. On the local level, clinical trials have the ability to generate considerable economic activity in and around the communities where they occur. On average, clinical trials account for 45 to 75% of the average $1.2 billion spent on developing a new drug. Clinical trials take from 6 to 7 years and are divided into three main phases. In phase one, researchers test the drug in a small group of people, usually between 20 and 80, for the first time, to evaluate its safety and tolerability, determine a safe dosage range, and identify any side effects. In phase two, the drug is given to a larger group of people, between 200 and 300, to see if it's effective and to further evaluate its safety. In phase three, the drug is given to large multicultural populations, between 1,000 and 3,000, to confirm its effectiveness, monitor side effects, compare it to commonly used treatments, and collect information that will allow the drug to be used safely. Research continues even after FDA approval. Post-marketing studies are conducted on new medicines to learn more about their risks, benefits, and optimal use. The drug may also be studied in subpopulations, such as children. Clinical trials are central to the work of biopharmaceutical researchers in advancing the science of bringing new medicines to the patients who need them.
Thank you. What I want to focus my comments on today is the role that clinical trials play in drug discovery and how our biopharmaceutical companies in Oregon are working together with Oregon universities, medical schools, research and cancer facilities on this very expensive and lengthy process, which ultimately benefits patients throughout the world. Right here in Oregon, our companies are or have conducted more than 2,300 clinical trials throughout the state since 1999. Currently, 235 of those clinical trials are actively recruiting patients, and in this report we include the URL so that patients and providers can find out which clinical trials are actively recruiting. Over half of the clinical trials in Oregon are for the six most prevalent chronic conditions, which include asthma, cancer, mental illness, heart disease, stroke, and diabetes. And these chronic diseases account for 75 cents of the healthcare dollar, and 7 out of 10 deaths are due to chronic disease. As you saw in the video, clinical trials are conducted in three phases, and that accounts for 7 of the 15 years that it takes to bring a drug to market. Clinical trials also accounts for 75% of the cost of research and development that goes into a new drug, approximately $1.2 billion. We also know that only one out of the 5,000 compounds ever make it to market. So that's a lot of failures, unfortunately, but I'm happy to report that we have 2,950 medications that are in the pipeline currently. So there's a lot of hope for patients and for us. Clinical trial business is good business for this state's economy as well. An Archstone report recently said that the biopharmaceutical industry provided more than 36,800 jobs in local bioscience and industry jobs, which generated $273 million in local and state revenue, taxes, and $1.9 billion in personal income. Clinical trials are conducted at the top university and medical schools and comprehensive cancer centers and research centers. In Oregon, our companies have a great selection from which to choose to do the clinical trials in. We are looking to Eugene, Bend, Medford, Coos Bay, Springfield, Gresham, Salem, Beaverton, and other Oregon communities, all of which are listed in this report. And even OHSU is ranked 36th among the top 100 research-oriented schools, which is very exciting. And the report stresses many of the treatments that are cutting edge. They're new generation biotech medicines. They're not all developed traditionally as those chemicals or compounds as they have been in the past. These are medications that are developed from biological processes using living cells. There's multiple exciting examples that I'd share, but I'm going to cut that. Finally, I want to share a personal story with you. I graduated from Texas Woman's University in Houston, Texas, many years ago, and I went to work at National Institutes of Health Clinical Center, and I worked for NINDS, the Neurological Disease and Stroke. And I remember, as a new nurse, working on this protocol with Fabry's patients. These are young men that have this neurological deficiency. They miss an enzyme that breaks down fat, and they typically show symptoms in their early 20s. Well, they eventually died because the fat deposits would go on every organ, the heart, the organs, the brain, and would eventually kill them. I was so happy to work on this protocol, which actually came up with we have a new medication that saves them, or at least prolongs their life, that breaks down that fat. And I just remember working with those patients who sacrificed. Their family sacrificed, the patient sacrificed, and now we have Fabrazyme, which is a wonderful new medicine that was created by Genzyme. And in collaboration with our scientists, it's so great to know that they are helping others that follow in their footsteps 10 years later. So that was really rewarding. But while I no longer work at NIH, it's equally rewarding to represent our 28 member companies and the scientists and all the work that they do every day to bring new treatments and cures to market. In summary, clinical trial business is good business for everyone involved working to develop the cutting-edge treatments for patients in Oregon and all around the world. They are all going to eventually benefit from taking these new medicines, and they have the potential to be safer and more effective than the older drugs. So thank you so much for your time and attention.
Thank you. Dr. Orwell?
My name's Eric Orwell. Excuse me. I'm a physician and investigator at OHSU, and I'm the Associate Vice President for Research at our institution. I want to take a little different approach than Sharon has. She's emphasized the partnership that happens between the pharmaceutical industry, investigators, and the community to bring new drugs to market. I want to point out that clinical trials or drug trials are only a part of clinical research. Clinical research includes the bench-to-bedside research that brings new drugs and diagnostics to the patient, but also includes a whole variety of other kinds of investigations that involve humans and communities. They are particularly germane for the struggle that you and the people that testified before us are dealing with in terms of how we transform healthcare. So we aren't going to be able to do that without understanding the process of healthcare transformation, and that means investigating how it's best done. So some of the clinical research that we're doing at OHSU now includes things like, what's the best way to approach back pain? What's the best way to design a medical home? The Oregon Rural Practice Research Network is heavily involved in the rural parts of the state to try and figure out how to deliver care in rural Oregon as opposed to an academic medical center where most of drug trials go on. So clinical research as opposed to drug-related clinical trials is a much broader enterprise. Sharon has made the point that clinical trials, again, drug development is an important economic engine for the state, but all of clinical research combined is a much larger economic engine. So at OHSU, medical research brings in about $315 million a year. Clinical research, and that means research involving humans, brings in about $120 million a year. Clinical trials is only a segment of that $120 million, about $40 million. So again, the majority of clinical research that's done at OHSU and probably in the state is not just drug development, a critical piece of that, but again, is about human health and optimizing human health. I want to be brief here. So let me end with a description of how important partnerships are to improving human health and bringing clinical research to the benefit of human health. There are investigators that are passionate about doing research, and there are a variety of motivations for that passion. But that's not going to take us where we need to be unless there is a very close partnership between those investigators and his or her community, the medical institutions in the community, the legislature, industry, both within the community and nationally. And it's that partnership that I think we need to foster, and we need to make sure that we all recognize the potential benefits of human investigation, its risks, how to regulate it, basically how to optimize it, again, to the benefit of human health. Let me stop there and leave plenty of time for questions.
Questions?
Yeah, a question and a comment. I mean, it is interesting that the significant economic impact on this. We had a luncheon with Dr. Drucker yesterday, one of the head of the
Nike Institute.
And he talked about dealing with a particular form of leukemia that had a survival rate of 2 to 3 years, and using the drug that he helped develop in partnership with a drug company, you end up with essentially people with a normal life expectancy. But now we've added $60,000 a year to the bill per person to keep those alive, which, I mean, is a bargain by any term. But it is this transformational kind of thing that I know you've been involved in. And I wonder if you could talk about this, the impact on both the life expectancy of the population by some of the drugs, somebody that's benefited, as I have, from from therapy. I'm probably here because of that today. And how we organize that in implementing into the healthcare community, which is...
Right. Yeah, a really important point, and why I wanted to stress that drug development alone is not the vision that we should have about this process. So we need new drugs, we need new devices. My son is a resident in pediatrics, and he and I talk about how transformed healthcare has been in the 30 years since I went to medical school and when he got out of medical school. Mm-hmm. It's dramatically different, in large part because of these discoveries we made. But as you say, we need to understand how to optimize the use of those in a time when we're trying to transform healthcare. And so that's why I made the point that drug development has to be associated with the research all along the spectrum, from bench to bedside, to how we put those new developments into populations, to how we develop the communities and the care that's provided to those communities, how we develop the policies and economics that will optimally take advantage of all those therapies. Comparative effectiveness is a form of research that is designed to compare Gleevec, which is Brian Druker's signal discovery, with all the other compounds that are now out there that are like Gleevec. How do we decide which ones of those are most efficient at taking care of the disease that we need to take care of? So again, drug discovery, a vital first step, but then a whole variety of other things that we need to pay attention to. I think that's your point.
And I would just add, if I may, just making sure that the regulatory environment is friendly, keep it open, that helps push innovation in research and discovery of these medicines.
Oregon is a really important laboratory for healthcare transformation. Yeah. And we have a unique opportunity in this state to figure out how to do it right. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of partnership that I was talking about before, between investigators that are passionate about not only developing drugs, but how to bring them to the benefit of the community in just the right way. So we can do this right, and we can do it in a way that leads the rest of the nation, and research is a really vital part of that process.
Thank you. I'm sure this will be the last thing we hear.
Just one more very, very brief question. We need to know on a regular basis whether there are statutory things that we need to help facilitate this. So, we do hear from OHSU, we do hear from Pharma, but it is important for us in far advance of the session if there are some statutory things that we think about. We've had some human subject stuff, we've had some genetic stuff, we've had some privacy things. It would be very useful if you stay ahead of the game for us.
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. One comment along those lines. It's not only statutory, but it's the partnership thing. And the state is a provider of health care. And by virtue of that, it is a potential partner in doing the kinds of research that we need to do to be in front of the game. So that means that the concept of the state as an investigator needs to be facilitated, needs to be developed. That doesn't depend so much on passing laws. It depends on how we formulate the state and investigators and the community as a team to do the kind of research we need to do.
Good. Thank you guys so much for coming.
One other issue, and I don't expect an answer, but it's something I think we need to pay attention to, is that we have a tendency here to develop products like Gleevec and put a lot of effort into them, only to see them transferred out of state for manufacturing and distribution, and we lose that part of the economic engine. And we need to be looking at collaborations where we can bring the manufacturing and keep a longer or larger part of the project in state. That's separate from the from the typical healthcare treatment mode, but it would be nice to get a larger return on our intellectual investment by having those drugs be part of the Oregon economy, which drug manufacturing is not a big deal here.
I completely agree with that, that there's a huge amount of intellectual capital that we should be realizing a better return on investment with, and then to grow our biotech industry. The collaborations that are important in doing that, I think, are in place. Lots of people are interested in doing it. We have a challenge here because we aren't San Diego or Boston. The venture capitalists that we would like to have in town are not here, but we have a great opportunity to do that.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And Randy, I guess you are our closing act for the waning moments.
Jim, while Randy's coming, should I talk about the work group?
Absolutely.
I just want to make sure we all know Representative Thompson and I have asked a work group to work on the question of direct entry midwives. We're going to hear a little bit about this now. And we've asked Representative Kenny Geyer, Representative Parrish, Representative Hoyle, Representative Doherty to sort of serve on that work group and to get some other members from outside. Representative Kenny Geyer has offered to chair the coordinate the activity, and that would be very useful.
Thank you.
I didn't know that.
And if Representative Parrish is willing to co-chair that, that would be very helpful. We hope you'll be able to develop whatever product we need in time for the next session, whatever that product is. We're not sure we know. Maybe you can help us, Randy. Thank you, Representative Thompson.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Thompson, members of the committee. My name is Randy Everett. I'm the director of the Oregon Health Licensing Agency. I'm here to bring an update on not only direct entry midwives, but there's also the Respiratory Therapy and Polysomnographic Technology Licensing Board, Body Art Practitioners. There's going to be some information that's going to be given to you that's going to cover a lot of that information right up front for you so you can see it, but I want to get first right into the direct entry midwives. Oregon Health Licensing Agency provides service to 10 boards and a commission. This represents 21 different professions, one of those being direct entry midwives. Right now, there are 75 direct entry midwives that are licensed within the state of Oregon. There's probably another 50 to 70 midwives that practice that are not licensed. Currently, in Oregon, midwives are paying we're paying $1,800 a year for their licensing fees. That the last legislative session dropped that to $1,200 per fee per year for our licensed midwives. And right now, this particular board is insolvent. They just went into the red about 3 weeks ago. We anticipate that the board will have an ending balance in 2013 of a negative $40,000. This is based on litigation, investigative expenses. Right now, 24% of our licensing base is under investigation, and the agency has just been advised of a $50.5 million lawsuit against the agency, the board, and several midwives in another part of the state. So, with that said,
we get to work quickly.
This particular licensing group is a challenge for the agency. We currently have 5 special investigators on staff. Some of them are retired FBI agents that are working with us to gather information regarding these particular complaints that come in. We right now have 32 outstanding complaints that we're working on regarding licensed direct entry midwives. We hope that they will be completed in a timely fashion throughout this summer and early fall, at least a good percentage of them, and we'll have better information to pass along as far as the results of, and the causes of those particular complaints. I think I'd like to stop here and ask if there are any questions regarding this particular piece.
Other than that, Randy, what's new?
Representative Hoyle, I'm in there.
I know we've spoken on numerous occasions, and I know that this is difficult.
It is.
This has been difficult for your organization to deal with. So out of the investigations that have been completed, what percentage of those investigations actually had an outcome that showed that there was negligence, like that had a bad outcome? What percentage? Because it seems to me that there is a really high percentage of investigations mm-hmm. for 75 licensed, you know, direct entry midwives. So either they are really inept at their job, or there is something forcing a high number of investigations. So what? Can you shed some light on that?
To some degree, I can. Representative Hoyle, members of the committee, what we're seeing right now in the investigations is that there are a number of complaints that that would be considered problematic, but don't necessarily have bad outcomes, meaning transport wasn't sufficient, or there was some sort of paper issue, notification kinds of things that you would normally see with any kind of a practice where the client feels that they were not treated fairly. Those, we're guessing right now, are probably about half of what the complaints are. The other half have dramatic outcomes that are in some instances very concerning to the agency and should be concerning to this body. So I would say about half of them are administrative in nature. The other half are going to be extremely dangerous.
So the outcomes are there are adverse outcomes.
Yes.
Are there adverse outcomes because of the actions of the direct entry midwife, or are there adverse outcomes because sometimes there's adverse outcomes when?
Representative, 12 members of the committee, yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes to both questions.
Jenny Parrish.
So I'm curious how other states are dealing with this issue, because I have spent a lot of time trying to read about it. I've certainly gotten letters about it. I've been pretty clear where I'm at on the issue, but curious what you think other states are doing comparatively with fees, and is this is the issue of investigations? I'm not seeing where other states are having this kind of problematic, and maybe I just haven't looked hard enough, but I'm not seeing where other states are having such a problematic time with midwives and having this same conversation across the country. Just kind of curious what you know about your peers.
Absolutely. Representative Parrish, members of the committee, Oregon has a very unique model that's different than any other state. And so when you have midwives that come in that have a certain authority to conduct their practice, it's very different in other states. Some states ban midwifery altogether, and so you don't have statistics based on that. Others have a much more collegial representation between hospitals and midwives. And so when you have in-home birth in Oregon, which is very different, then you're going to have a whole different set of outcomes and a whole different set of statistics regarding investigations and complaints. We believe right now, based on what we're talking to with other states and seeing coming in, is the way this particular group was established by the legislature years ago lends to this kind of investigative complaint mechanism. When you basically, they were brought in to essentially be able to be paid for services that they render. And so when you're looking at their scope of practice as well as in their practice standards that the board is responsible for, there's not a lot of guidance out of this particular state at this time. So it's different here than other places. And that's where I think you're seeing a large number of complaints come in. And they're a very high-profile group right now. They're in the news all the time. Outcomes that are bad in this particular state are reaching the news media. And that begets more complaints that come in behind them.
Can I follow up?
Please.
So one of the questions I recall asking in 2011 was cross-comparative, the midwife cohort of babies being delivered compared to hospital deliveries and outcomes, and I still haven't seen any kind of data on that. Has there been any progress in cross-comparing that? Because if not, that is definitely going to be something I would hope that we talk about in a work group, and actually, because I still don't have apples to apples to compare.
Right. Representative Parrish, members of the committee, you're absolutely right. That's a great question. In June, the agency will be gathering data on out-of-hospital births. It's a system that's been developed with the assistance of the board, so we'll start collecting data where in the past there was no mechanism truly in place for us to compare apples to apples. Mm-hmm. And truly, it's been apples to oranges before that. Bureau of Vital Statistics is collecting data starting during this next year. So we're going to be able to help with that kind of data, kind of give you a better idea of what out-of-hospital risks are for our home birth midwives. So it's in place, but it has not been helpful up to this point. But we expect within the next year that we'll have better data to talk about that. So it's in place.
Just follow on real fast. I guess my concern is, you know, when you bring up the fact that there's been spotlight in the media, and certainly I've read those articles in the last, you know, year and a half, you know, when there's a bad outcome in a hospital, whether it's a natural cause or a doctor who has a bad outcome, those are not as dramatic and publicized for one reason or another. And I think, you know, part of the fact that Oregon does do the midwife thing a little differently, and that, you know, there's just a lot of people who still consider it fringe. It wasn't my choice for my kids. That actually is lending itself to the kind of dramatic news media piece that goes with it, and yet we don't see that same outcome when there's a bad, you know, when a baby dies in a hospital. And so I think it's unfair to, you know, say this is kind of dramatic in the media when we don't cover babies that die in the hospital in the media, comparatively. Anyway, that was just more follow-on comment than a question.
Anything else? Well, we're out of time, ladies and gentlemen.
Can I ask one more thing, a separate thing? And for future reference, we've been hearing about totally unlicensed people injecting Botox. And it's coming to our attention, and it's going to be on our somewhere or other on our screens in the next period. Do those people in any way come under any of your boards?
Well, Representative Greenleck, we've also been receiving complaints of Botox injections for aesthetics and all of those things. Aesthetics does come under OHLA and one of our boards, under the cosmetology board. We don't have a lot of direction and a lot of guidance regarding that particular piece of that. So you may hear not only Botox, but laser work that's being done out there by aestheticians. We do have current issues that we're dealing with right now internally.
Well, you're looking into it, and we'll hear more about it. And
yes, sir.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty frightening to hear the things that I've heard.
Yes.
Representative Doherty has a closing comment.
I assume we're closing this out. I just had on the piercing issues, and just reading over this, and remember we went through this last session, you guys. So the dermal implants and the scarification and those things are, you cannot do that in Oregon. Was that part of the rulemaking?
That's correct.
Okay, good.
I'm sure we'll have you back for further discussion. You have all the interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I'm happy to be of service to this committee at any time.
And with that, we will close out the meeting of the House Healthcare Committee until, I presume, September, unless we have an emergency.
Was it?